Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. I just want to make an announcement about the agenda because I know many of you are here to hear about plastic bags. However, we're going to follow our agenda today and do our other committee business first. We have an introduction of committee measures, and then we'll hear about a couple of tax credits, so you'll get to see some other policy issues before we move on to plastic bags. I'm going to just remind folks, if you haven't signed up, if you would like to testify, we have sign-up sheets, so those are right by the door,
outside.
And so I expect it'll be about 15 or 20 minutes before we start that portion of the public hearing. And also a reminder, if you have a cell phone, please make sure it is off or on silent, number one. And two, if you have written testimony, the protocol is to hand that to our ABLE staff committee member, Sue, and I will be asking you to paraphrase and not read your testimony. Also, because of the number of people that want to testify, we will be limiting testimony, and we have a little stopwatch to make sure that everybody who came gets a chance to have their say. So with that, we're going to do our first order of business, and we're going to open up a work session for introduction of committee measures. And while I will accept a motion, do you want to go first?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move that the LC 3551 dated 2811 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Senator Olson moves that LC 3551 dated 2811 be introduced as a committee bill. And I just want to mention that introduction of a committee bill does not necessarily mean that members of this committee support the bill, but it's just introduction for discussion purposes. So with that, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. Do we need to open up another work session then? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I move that Senate Bill LC 3779, dated 1-27-2011, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves that LC 3779, dated 1-27-2011, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objections? Seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. And with that, we will close the work session on introduction of committee measures, and we will move to our first public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 319. And Beth, if you can give a brief description, please.
319. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 319 would adjust the sunset date for tax credits for diesel engines, both new engines and engine retrofitting and repowering. The bill would also repeal the sunset of the tax credits. There may be a fiscal or revenue impact. We don't have statements on that yet, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'm going to invite up Senators Burdick and Senator Morse. And Paul, do you want to come up to the dais as well? Okay. We have the chair and the vice chair of the Senate Revenue Committee that's going to give us an overview on the tax credits and also provide us with some insights about the tax credit review process. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You never thought that tax credits could draw such a crowd, right?
First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. For the record, I'm Ginny Burdick. I represent the people of Senate District 18, and I chair the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Thank you for having me before your committee. My purpose and Senator Morse's purpose for being here is to kind of go over some of our expectations and our hopes for this committee. This is the first policy committee that we are appearing before, the first policy committee that we know of that is taking up a sunset issue. So this is our kind of maiden voyage to try to give some direction and hopefully some advice on what would be helpful as we go through the review of these. So I will turn it over to my vice chair to introduce himself, and then we will tell you what our expectations are.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Morrison. We're happy to be trendsetters here today.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, I represent District 8, which is the Albany-Corvallis area of Lynn and Benton counties. And it's our pleasure to be here before you by way of information to the audience. This is the first of an effort to look at what we have set in motion over literally probably decades, Paul, by way of tax credits to make sure that, in fact, they meet their intended purposes. And for that reason, we're before you here today to outline what would be hopefully the thoughtful considerations that you would then bring to the tax credit joint committee, which will then receive all of the policy recommendations and then bring forward measures reflecting that.
Thank you.
So thank you.
So our first question that we would like the committee to address is, what is the public policy purpose of the credit? And is there an expected timeline for actually achieving the goal? In the past, as you know, tax credits typically did not have sunsets, and so it became very difficult to change them from incentives, to keep them as incentives, because they very quickly became entitlements. So what we want to know is what to clearly identify the public policy credit and to really try to set a timeline for how soon you expect that policy goal to be met.
And then who benefits from the tax credit, including individuals, organizations, and businesses? So we have a clear understanding of the direction and the intent of that tax credit.
The next issue is, what is expected to happen if this credit fully sunsets? Could adequate results be achieved with a scaled-down version of the credit? For example, what would be the effect of reducing the credit by 50% or by some other percentage?
Another issue is background information, which I would call benchmarking with other states that have this type of credit. What impacts have they had, and consider information beyond their own borders.
Is the use of this tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve this policy goal, or are there other methods that might be more effective?
What other incentives, including state and local subsidies, federal tax expenditures or subsidies, are available that attempt to achieve a similar policy goal?
Could this credit be modified to make it more effective and or efficient? If so, how?
And in the case of multiple credit extension bills assigned to your committee, how do they rank in terms of effectiveness and efficiency? So the bills that come before you, what is the highest priority and what is the lowest priority, and why? Is it more effective to maintain one credit at its current level and eliminate others, or proportionately reduce more than one credit?
And in conclusion, this is a groundbreaking review process. In the last session, you'll recall, we passed House Bill 2067, which placed all 50 or so tax credits on a sunset schedule. And in this tough budget year, it's important to note that these tax credits that are sunsetted this year, some of them have quite a high revenue cost, are all in the current forecast as zero. So funding the tax credits will be additional revenue impact on the 2011 budget, 2011-13 budget, that is not now currently in the forecast. So it puts the tax credits on a more even playing field with other spending priorities that we have as a state. And I want to thank this committee for taking on some of the most difficult and complicated tax credits. I know that from experience, especially working with your wonderful chair. And any assistance we can be, we are there to help in any way, including coming back before this committee if you think it would be helpful. And we'd be happy to answer questions.
Great. Well, thank you both of you for your leadership on this important issue. It's something that some of us up here have been working on for a long time as well, so we appreciate you bringing this forward. Any questions? Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have two questions if I can. First is, you've given us kind of the framework that you want us as a substantive committee to be working with. Could you have Mr. Warner provide us that list so when we're going through these, we'll be able to do some type of a checkoff as to how you would want us to rate and rank them?
Yes, we will.
Second question, and I guess is the process, knowing that we're probably going to see more than today, we have two that are here for public hearing that deals with tax credits. Is it your prerogative to have us hold all of these and then do some type of ranking? Because one of the things I've heard was to put a priority. And if we're, how can we prioritize if we only have two, if we're going to get another 13 or whatever that number might be in the future, how would we be able to accomplish that goal for you?
It's my understanding that there are similar bills for the extending the tax credits in both the House and Senate. So both the House and Senate policy committees that have primary jurisdiction over the credits will receive the bill. You should already have the bills in your possession.
Okay.
Because they were pre-session filed. So you should have now or very soon a full agenda of the credits that fall within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair?
Follow-up?
Yeah. It's really more, I guess, for us as a committee, if that's the case, is it the Chair's prerogative or a thought that we would bring these okay. as a bundle, looking at all the tax credit bills in 1 or 2 days, and then have that opportunity to have a work session to do the ranking that they've requested us to do?
I think it's an excellent question, and we'll be discussing it with the chairs here,
okay.
Co-chairs here, because I think right now they're sort of dribbling in. We happen to get these two, so we scheduled a hearing. So I think what one of the things we need to know is what's the universe of bills that we should expect to see on, obviously, connected with natural resource issues, and then the timing, when you would like to have a response, because certainly if we're looking at a ranking, then my inclination is that we're going to wait, have all the bills, and then move them.
Right. And Madam Chair, I just was informed by our legislative revenue officer, Dr. Paul Werner, that the last batch of bills will be in your possession, that are in the jurisdiction of this committee, will be in your possession in about a week.
Okay. Great. Well, I think we'll work together to make sure we get a schedule that's mutually agreeable. Great. All right. Thank you. I think we have a few folks signed up that like to testify, and certainly you're welcome to stick around. And if you're interested in plastic bags, you can stay the rest of the evening.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask the next three folks to come up together. Doesn't mean that you're necessarily all on the same side of the issue, but Bob Russell, Ralph Groner, and Dick Peterson, if you can come up, please. Welcome. Whoever wants to go first.
Dick? Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And as reported, I'm here to talk about diesel engine tax credits. DEQ processes tax credit requests for both new truck engines and the repower and retrofit of diesel engines. Diesel engines commonly found on large trucks, marine vessels, and construction equipment are significant emitters of particulate pollution and toxics, and that connects obviously to the tax credit. There's two types of tax credits that are here, and I'm going to talk about each one of them very, very briefly. The first one is called the truck engine tax credit, and clean burning EPA certified engines installed in new trucks purchased and registered in Oregon are eligible for a tax credit. And the credit only applies to engine models years between 2003 and 2013. The tax credit range from $400 per engine to $925 per engine, depending on the number of trucks owned prior to purchasing the new engine. It's a sliding scale for smaller businesses would get a bigger credit, whereas larger businesses would get a smaller credit. DEQ has the authority to approve up to $500,000 in truck engine tax credits each calendar year, but no more than $80,000 to any one taxpayer. In the 2007-2009 biennium, DEQ approved a little over 1,000 eligible engines for about $484,000 in tax credit, which is about half of the total amount authorized for the two-year period. We expect about the similar amount in the current biennium that we're in now. While we don't have definitive emission numbers, reduction numbers for the new engine tax credit, we estimate that about 19 tons of particulate emissions may be reduced each year as a result of this credit. The second component of the tax credit is for diesel repower and retrofit. And in 2007, the legislature approved the repower and retrofit tax credit. Both of these tax credits require about that 50% of the usage in Oregon for at least 3 subsequent years. So if we retrofit or repower through the tax credit, that engine has to be used in Oregon for 50% of its time in the subsequent 3 years. Repower means replacing an older, higher polluting engine with a less polluting new used or remanufactured engine. The credit is limited to non-road engines and requires scrapping the old engine, so it cannot be used for anything but scrap metal. Retrofit means to upgrade currently operating diesel engines with new advanced exhaust controls to reduce the most harmful pollutants with the greatest impact to public health and the environment. DEQ may certify a maximum of $3 million in clean diesel repower or retrofit tax credits in any one calendar year. In the 2007 biennium, DEQ approved repower and retrofit credits for a total of about $360,000. In 2009, this current biennium, we expect to issue about $1.3 million in tax credits. So in summary, with these diesel tax credits, they both provide economic and environmental benefit. For example, for each dollar spent on diesel reduction, there is about a $5 environmental and public health benefit. That's reported from EPA studies. And the tax credits are just one of several strategies that that the state and DEQ uses to reduce diesel emissions. We do get some federal money that's applied to diesel retrofit as well, and continue to work with not only providing that money, but in outreach campaigns to help trucks with how to best repower, retrofit, and replace older diesel engines. So with that, Madam Chair, that's what my report is to you.
Okay, thank you, Director. And you'll be following up with a handout on this, or did we receive one and we don't have it?
No.
I think it would be helpful.
We can provide some,
you could,
Madam Chair.
Just document the information.
Yes. Yep.
So why don't we hear from the trucking industry, Mr. Russell?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell, representing the Oregon Trucking Associations. Mr. Peterson did a great job in sort of explaining what these are. These are two separate programs. The new engine tax credit actually went into effect in 2003. And the idea here is to provide incentives so that we upgrade our engines as the new EPA regulations have gone into effect over the years. So each session we've modified this tax credit so it only applies to the current engine that's being manufactured. So, for example, in 2004, we had a new engine that dramatically dropped the NOx content of our exhaust. In 2007, we had the next version of engine, and it was equipped with particulate traps, and it reduced 95% of the particulate emissions from our exhaust. You may have seen the cartoons and stuff with all the black smoke coming out of trucks. Actually, that hasn't happened for years, but with the particulate traps, there's no more black anything. It's virtually gone. And actually, Kevin Downing from DEQ says that the 2007 engines, the air coming out of the exhaust is cleaner than the air in downtown Los Angeles. We now have the 2010 engines, which further dropped the NOx. So we've now reduced NOx by 95%. We've reduced particulates by 95%. And instead of being cleaner than the air in Los Angeles, the exhaust is now cleaner than the air in Portland. And I often joke that we're going to route the exhaust into the cab of the truck to make sure that our drivers are more healthy. So we've really dramatically cleaned up the emissions from these diesel engines. These are on-road diesels. This is the trucking industry. This does not apply to construction or anything else. It's been synchronized with the EPA regulations, so we're always incentivizing the most current engines. We have another version of engine that will be coming out in 2014. That's the last of the series. I don't quite know what the technology is that we will be using in 2014. Our vision has always been, and to respond to some of Senator Burdick's issues, is that once we get through this cycle with EPA of cleaning up our on-road diesel engines, and that we will then sunset this tax credit and it will go away. As Mr. Peterson said, It's capped at $500,000 per year. It's capped at $80,000 per company. In recent years, we've been using less than half of the $500,000 in part because of the economy. Mm-hmm. We certainly can't afford to buy the new trucks that we used to buy. And also, it's gotten to the point that I think that in 2010, we'll have even used less. I've had large members tell me that the fee for processing the tax credits is $50, which is nominal, but they would rather have the cash today from not paying the fee than they would having the tax credits in the future, because these tax credits can be spread over a four-year period. However, the good news is the economy is picking up. My members all over the state are saying that they're hauling more freight. So we're going to be buying some new trucks, and I think this is a very important tax credit and really does have a very positive impact on the environment. And the clean diesel program is different, and I'm sure that Ralph is going to talk about that. We actually put that together in 2007. It applies to all kinds of engines, not mm-hmm. just on-highway truck engines. When we designed it, it had tax credits, it had grants, and it had loans as the sort of the components of how we could do this to give DEQ the maximum flexibility. I'm told by DEQ staff that there has actually been one truck that's received a tax credit for a retrofit under this program since its inception in 2007. So most of the work that DEQ is doing in this area is either grants or loans, it's not the tax credits, or it's in off-highway kinds of engines, if that helps.
Okay. Great. And if you want to wrap up briefly, Ralph, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner with Ask Me, resident of Oregon City. Welcome, my senator here. I want to speak just shortly. We belong to the diesel subcommittee that worked hard on this for years, and I'll only say this, that diesel is harmful to the health and the environment, and my Ask Me members of Local 3336, which I represent, have reached out to Oregon Diesel Industries and helped with the use of the tax credits to help reduce pollution and save fuel for the companies. The only grant funds are the federal funds, and our members have reached out and acted as consultants to numerous industries to help facilitate grant applications to federal grants and to make them more competitive than other states such as Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. My understanding, I had an approximation of how much has been brought in through this work from the federal, is over $7 million. This state is showing more efficient use of federal tax dollars by the fact that we've had the tax credit and we've had the staff that were committed to the clean diesel program. EPA evaluates our applications and places high marks on those who leverage their funds along with federal funds, and that's an important point. Oregon applicants such as Associated General Contractors have successfully received federal grants with our help, as well as Tidewater Barge Lines, Shaver Transportation, and City of Portland's, Milwaukee, Lake Oswego, and Little Athena Weston School District. We have all benefited to the time over, I said, $7 million. One of the comments to make is black carbon is a potent greenhouse gas, and the impact of black carbon is 2,000 more times more potent than carbon monoxide. That's according to the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Tugboats we've worked on with their engines save 140,000 gallons of fuel per year per boat, i.e. Tidewater. The savings evaluates to two positive impacts, 85% of climate change by the carbon, and as well as the health of our public, which is considered nationally due to diesel pollutants at billions of dollars. In closing, this program, even if we are as absolutely as parsimonious as we have to be now, understandably very few dollars, but this is a program that helps not only reduce the fuel consumption, but reduce the pollution in the air that causes a very, that's why OHSU, another one of my locals, has declared itself free, diesel free, was the first hospital in Oregon to do so, not allowed on the campus. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll see if there's any questions before we let you go, although I'm sure we'll be doing some follow-up. Any questions? Okay. And if you have, if you would be so kind to submit your testimony via email to Beth Petrino, the committee staff, so we can share it. I think that would be helpful.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody else would like to testify on this bill, Senate Bill 319? We don't have anybody else signed up. Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 319. We'll open up a public hearing on the next tax credit bill, Senate Bill 320. Beth?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Senate Bill 320 adjusts the sunset of the tax credit for reforestation, removes the deadline for filing written requests for preliminary certification. There may be a revenue and fiscal impact to this bill. We don't have statements yet, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Okay, excellent. And I'm going to invite up the Department of Forestry, Steve Vaught.
Yes.
Is that correct? Why don't you come up to give the introduction, and then I'll call up the rest of the panel. If you can provide an overview on this, the policy, please, that would be helpful.
I'll do that. We have prepared information.
Great.
We'll give to you, so we'll give you an overview on it.
Okay.
The tax credit, which is commonly called reforestation tax credit, was enacted in 1979 as part of the Woodland Management Act. The Woodland Management Act was enacted for a variety of reasons, but primarily to encourage long-term forestry investments on private forest land. The tax credit, reforestation tax credit,
Yes, and could you identify yourself for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Steve Vaught. I'm the incentives coordinator for the Private Forest Division, Department of Forestry.
Thank you.
The tax credit fit in under the Woodland Management Act by promoting the establishment of new forest crops on denuded or otherwise underproductive privately owned forest lands. The credit does not apply to lands which have been harvested and are required under the Oregon Forest Practices Act to be reforested. The credit is primarily available to landowners that are converting brush land or other underproductive forest land back into forest, basically. The credit has gone through a number of changes over the last several decades. It started out at 10%. Usage by the public was not great. Also, at that time, there was a limitation on the landowner size, so it was mainly limited to very small landowners. Subsequently, the credit increased to 30%, and the landowner size restrictions were taken away, and so the large industrial owners could participate. After that happened, about in the mid-90s, the use of the program increased exponentially, dramatically. However, since the mid-90s, the use of the program has steadily decreased to this time, and it's being used at a rate of about 500 acres per year of new applications. The credit basically at this point provides a landowner with 50% of eligible costs to establish a forest and underproducing forest land. The costs right now, on average, are running for all landowner groups about $500 an acre. The credit amount, based on the data that we have that is being provided against that $500 per acre, is approximately $182 per acre. So the department feels that the program has been effective in that Over the years since 1979, approximately 65,000 acres of underproducing forest land have been converted to forest. And that concludes my comments.
Okay, I am going to ask a question, and then we'll see if there's other questions before they bring the panel up. So I will ask your opinion or the department's opinion if you think this is still necessary. This has been around now a long time.
It's been around a long time.
And correct. So do you think we've incentivized enough, or do you feel that this is still necessary in your
professional
opinion?
I think to the degree that the program is used over time following certain events, I'll call them natural disasters, such as wildfire, insect disease attacks, and ice storms and such, we are having landowners use the program at that level to help rehabilitate those kinds of stands post-disaster, let's put it that way. And in that regard, these are stands which have been damaged to the extent that they will not pay their way out of the woods. So it has been used quite a bit for that.
And just to follow up to that, I don't have the tax incentive book in front of me, but when I read this, I do recall it wasn't a huge amount per year. Can you tell me what it's been over time? And then is there a cap on this, as there was on the previous tax credit that we heard?
There is the amount that's being used right now on an annual basis, and this is the total credit amount, not to get into the details of this, but our records show it's about $196,000 a year.
Per year or per biennium?
Per year.
Okay. And is there a cap?
There is a cap. I don't have that exactly with me, but we have never come anywhere close to the cap. I believe it's approximately $3.5 million. I have to check that.
Okay. And is there a cap per project or per owner?
There is no cap per project or owner. However, we do look at costs and make sure that it, all eligible costs, that we're only approving eligible costs.
Okay. Other questions for the department? Senator Haas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on the Joint Tax Committee, the tax credit bill. Referred to, and I just want to say that this really does mark a change from the old days, because of the law that was passed. Now, in order to get a tax break, in order to keep getting it, groups have to come before legislators and justify it, as opposed to prior to that law, where they were just they would always be there, and they didn't get the kind of scrutiny that they're now getting. They didn't get the kind of scrutiny that you get in ways and means on expenditures, even though they had the exact same effect on the state budget. Mm-hmm. So I think this is very positive, and these are two very worthy tax credits. But I think it's healthy to come in and say, okay, are these still working? Maybe they should be changed, maybe not. But I think that's a really good law.
Yeah, thank you. I concur. This is new for us, and I think that given that we work in a lot of these policy issues, I think it's valuable. Any questions on this side of the dais?
No.
Okay, so we'll have the panel come up. Thank you very much, and I will ask you to follow up if you can email information, and I think we are going to have some follow-up questions that we're going to be asking the agencies to submit.
We'll be with the written testimony here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then I'm going to ask Jim James, Jake Gibbs, and Link Cannon. Link somewhere, come up, and then that's all I have, unless there's anybody else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 320, we'll move on to the bag hearing after that. Thank you, gentlemen. Whoever wants to go first, and just a reminder, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members members of the committee, for the record, my name is Link Cannon. I work for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Oregon Forest Industries Council, or the large forest land owners in the state. Our members own over 4 million acres of forest land in Oregon. With me today are Jake Gibbs from Lone Rock Timber, who is a member of OFIC, who will give you some technical detail on how they've utilized the program and the benefits, and also Jim James, representing the Oregon Small Woodland Association. I'll be very brief. OFIC supports this tax credit. We think it's been very important in establishing forest lands where they wouldn't otherwise exist. And the economics of underproductive lands are very touch and go, as you'll hear from Jake. If you ever tried to get blackberries out of your back lot, you know it's a challenging exercise, and that's what foresters face with assorted brush and species on these underproductive lands. So it's expensive, and often wouldn't happen without this tax credit. It's a relatively low-cost program that has worked very well. It's been in place for a long time because it has worked well, we think. It encourages private landowners to establish new forests where they wouldn't otherwise be or would otherwise be uneconomic, and there are a lot of attendant environmental and economic benefits to that, including carbon sequestration and growing wood for our timber industry, as well as establishing wildlife and those kinds of things. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Gibbs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jake Gibbs, forester and part of the management team at Lone Rock Timber out of Roseburg, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity. Mr. Cannon kind of summarized most of my reasons for being here. I would just point out that some of the numbers Lone Rock Timber has utilized this program since 1990. We have, I would say, expanded our land ownership via this program about 6,100 acres, and after listening to Mr. Vaught's testimony, that puts it as about 10% of the total program. So I would say we've utilized it very well. I use the word expand our ownership. These are lands we owned that had very little commercial value, brush fields, blackberries, not producing commercial products. Today, in the packets that I've distributed, are pictures of some of those investments 20 years later. Last week, I took advantage of the nice weather to revisit what 20-year-old reforested sites look like, and I would just show, use those as examples of what the state has gained from its investment in this program. Very productive sites for a variety of, or for commercial purposes, but also for things we weren't inventorying 20 years ago, be that carbon, which wasn't part of my vernacular in school, and biomass, which is those are in my inventory programs now, whereas 15 years ago, those were kind of just sidebar items, if anything. So those are value added, I would say, that this program has provided on those lands that wouldn't have that value today. And I guess I'd just kind of stop. I'll end up right there. I think that's enough for that. Our costs, one thing I would add is our costs that we've attributed to this program or to reforesting these lands are a bit higher than what Mr. Vaught shared. We're closer to $700 an acre if we were to do this all on our own. So utilizing this program whereas a Douglas fir typical stand is significantly less, between $400 and $500 to reforest. So there are incurred costs. Added cost to reclaiming these lands. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelter, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 320. My name is Jim James. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. OSWA has around 1,500 family forest landowners. OSWA represents landowners who have between 1 and 5,000 acres of forest land. The reforestation tax credit is and has been a very valuable element in decision-making on whether small landowners would reforest or take underproductive lands and turn them into healthy forests. In a fire or insect situation, the cost of that type of reforestation would be extensive, and most family woodland owners would not be able to afford to do that without the tax credit and the government assistance in those areas. This is a very important program and one that I would encourage you to support. Roger Beyer has already given you a written testimony from OSWA, and my comments here are just to kind of facilitate the importance of this to our landowners. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much for coming here today and for your testimony.
Thank you.
And before I close the public hearing, first of all, is there anybody else who would like to testify in this bill? Before I close the public hearing, I've asked the committee staff to follow up with the agencies on additional information. So we may be having additional public hearings or work sessions. Stay tuned for both of these tax credit bills. Since this is new for our committee, I think there's additional information we need before we take action on these bills. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 320. And Senator Haas, I'm going to open up a hearing on the next bill. And before I do that, I just want to remind folks we're going to have a presentation from the co-sponsors of the bill, and then we'll be calling up witnesses, try to alternate folks. We have four pages of folks who have signed up to testify. Going to alternate for and against in a limit to 2 minutes, because I'm sure probably most of you don't want to be here until 10 o'clock tonight, but I want to make sure everybody who came has a chance to express their opinions. So again, I'm going to emphasize, if you have written testimony, please do summarize it. If it's been stated before, if you could not repeat what's been said previously, and if you do have written testimony, please hand it to Sue. And with that, we're going to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 536. Beth, if you would read a summary of the bill.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Senate Bill 536 would prohibit a retail establishment from providing a single-use checkout bag to customers effective November 11, 2011. The bill would allow retail establishments to provide reusable checkout bags at no cost, for sale at no cost, recycled paper checkout bags at no cost to customers using the Women, Infant, and Children program and Oregon Trail electronic benefit card users, recycled checkout paper bags if the charge is not less than 5 cents per bag, and single-use checkout bags for items marked with protected health information or other confidential information. The bill defines retail establishment, which does not include those establishments whose primary business is the preparation of food and drink, and finally prohibits local governments from imposing a tax fee or charge on recycled paper, reusable, single-use, or any other checkout bag provided by an establishment.
Great, thank you. And Senator Atkinson, would you like to come up to the dais as the chief co-sponsor, and Senator Hass, would you like to introduce the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. You know, anybody who's worked on one of those Solve Beach cleanups is very familiar with this issue. 12% of the garbage collected on those Solve cleanups by volume is plastic bags. Oregonians consume 1.7 billion plastic bags a year, and less than 5% of them are turned back into those stores for recycling. The last time Oregon's litter problem was this bad, Oregon responded with a bottle bill. Since then, our roadsides and beaches have been free of beer cans and pop bottles, but those same roadsides and beaches have now, in the last 10 years or so, become refuge for non-biodegradable bags. Those bags have been hard on Oregon's environment, and they've been especially hard on Oregon's economy. In my own district, 300 jobs exist in a plant where they make recycled paper bags. And in my own district, I have large recycling facilities where now more than a third of their operating costs are due to trying to unclog their giant sorting machines from plastic bags. So I will be brief. I won't show a long slideshow because we've got many people, and I'm happy to say that we have a bipartisan group of legislators here in this building who are supporting this. We also have a coalition of businesses, of grocers, of recyclers, of paper manufacturers, and very pleased to have my colleague, Senator Atkinson.
Great. Thank you. Senator, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senators, for the record, my name is Jason Atkinson. And I am very proud to serve with my colleague, Senator Hass, on this particular message and measure being bipartisan. As you know, this is a issue that has now, are we at a year old, thereabouts? And I just wanted to put a few things on the record in introduction. There's a tremendous amount of discussion going on in email and through all of our offices. But let me give a bit of a historical perspective of why we have chosen the direction we're at. And before you today is a bill that is really landmark in the terms of being inclusive of several groups that I hope you'll hear from. One is the grocery industry. Two is municipalities. And three are people who have asked, at least as long as I've been in this building, to increase harvest of sustainable timber. And so if you look at those three items, you really do have the makings of what could be landmark legislation. And as the good senator from Beaverton has suggested, right now Oregon would be the first. Oregon will not be the last. There will be other states. In fact, for a while, there was other states that just by the sheer timing of their legislatures were looking at similar proposals. Why this one works so well is that Oregon doesn't make anything that's plastic, but we do grow a lot of trees. And I have always looked at that from a consumer perspective and also from a jobs perspective, whether or not there's a tremendous amount of support for this measure. You do know that Oregon does produce trees, and we're always here, whether we're talking about something as broad as ONC lands or something as broad as timber communities, we're always looking at ways to make sure that small communities that rely on that timber are healthy. The next portion of this has to do with the industry. Never before, at least in our country, has the industry sat down, really through the leadership of my colleague, to say, how can we be part of the solution? Now, there's a threat here from the third element, which is local municipalities. Many local municipalities across Oregon have worked with us and very closely with my colleague to suggest that if you, the legislature, don't act, we will act. And so what's before us today is coming together on a bipartisan statewide solution or being back here 2 years from now talking about local preemption. Local preemption meaning that one municipality might do one version of a plastic bag ban, another community might do something entirely different, and then a third or fourth or sixth community could come up with something either a higher, perhaps a tax, perhaps a ban, we don't know what, but it's up to, at that point, municipalities. And we've seen that before. There has been landmark legislation that really is a precedent to this effort. If you look at, I was just outside thinking, how would I prepare myself to say something? And there is a banner just outside this room that says, Oregon Landmark Legislation, and then it has the following quote. This law is socialist, stupid, and economically ridiculous. And that phrase was made about the thing that we have called no self-service gas in Oregon. If you look at what I've just read to you, you could apply the exact same political winds and the political pressures to the Oregon Bottle Bill, which was highly successful, a model that the rest of the country did follow. If you look at the degree of damage that plastic does, both in our waste stream and downriver, especially to fish habitat, you know that this is a real issue. And it's very interesting to note that the municipalities of, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Tillamook, Cannon Beach, and I think Astoria have all looked at locally passing supporting measures being downstream at the end of the waste stream. So there's certainly an economical benefit with regards to timber and jobs. There's certainly an environmental benefit. And there's also one thing that happens in Oregon so rarely, which is people from urban and rural and both parties coming together to craft something. And for that, I'm very happy. I will end my comments with this. Recently, I was overseas in a place that is not as clean as Oregon. I was at a place that has had environmental threats, but more important than them to look at environmental threats have been their own society and economy and social justice. I was in South Africa. In South Africa, people have a very us Westerners have very interesting ideas about South Africa and what South Africa is all about. Interesting to note that South Africa does have a small timber, nothing like Oregon, but they don't make oil-based plastic. They banned plastic bags. Countries have been banning plastic bags, and they did it for two reasons. One was the waste stream and just how much litter it was devastating their country. They also did it for their ocean. And being at the very tip of two different oceans, the Indian and the Atlantic, they said, we got to be part of the solution. So with that, I think that you're going to hear from hopefully municipalities who have worked with the coalition to make sure that we, the legislature, had a chance at a statewide solution. Hopefully you're going to hear from timber. And certainly I'm sure you'll hear from both sides. One side, I'm sure, we'll get back to the socialist, stupid, and economically ridiculous. And then from some, I'm sure you'll hear that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread for the environment. I will say, in joining with Senator Haas, that this is probably somewhere in the middle, and it's probably, for that very reason, very Oregon-like. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions before the Senator leaves? We're not going to let you off that easy.
Yeah, we are.
Okay. You are being let off easy. Thank you, Senator.
A lot of other people.
Okay, with that, we've got a lot of folks that would like to testify. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to be calling up three at a time, and I am going to ask if you can limit your remarks to 2 minutes, please. There won't be a big hook that will take you off if you go over, but I might have my staff start waving at you, but also for respect of all the people in this room that would like to be heard. I'm also going to try to call up folks that came from far away first, so we make sure that they get heard if they need to get in their car and drive back to where they came from. So with that, I'm going to start by calling up Bill Gardner. Bill Gardner, Joe Gilliam, and Jeff Murray. Oh, Joe, you know what? Let me have Gus Gates come up first, because Gus came from far away. We want to make sure that he can. Okay? Where's Gus? Okay. Yes, you came from over 100 miles, so we want to get you up there first. Okay. Great. Thank you. And whoever wants to get started, we're going to start the clock. Yes?
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Gardner. I'm the general manager for International Paper's craft bag business. We convert paper into grocery and fast food type bags. We've got 4 operations in Beaverton that are kind of tied together. We've got an ink and plate plant, a bag plant, a box plant, and a recycling center. And among all those, we have about 300 employees located in Beaverton. And then across Oregon, we've got 900 employees at 12 different locations across the state. The paper industry is brought into the discussion when there's a discussion about plastic bags, because a lot of times there starts to be some deflection around the plastic environmental discussion, and then what's paper really do to the environment. And so we've learned that we need to make sure that we're proactive and we get our message out in terms of the benefits of paper bags. Paper bags have been around for over 150 years. Over the last 30 years is when the plastic grocery bag was introduced, and over that time, paper bags have basically been relegated to those stores and those consumers that value the environmental benefit of paper bags over plastic bags. First, I'd like to address the commonly accepted points of why paper is good for the environment. The fact is that paper bags, unlike plastic, naturally decompose. So should they become litter, they'll decompose in the environment. They're safe for wildlife, so there's no impact to wildlife. They're made from renewable resources, so you've got a product that doesn't have an end of life. And then they're highly recycled. In fact, paper recycling is becoming a huge environmental success story in this country. The recent EPA numbers for paper and plastic packaging have now reached 72% of all paper packaging is recovered and recycled. We also like to address, there are some studies, the common thing is to bring forward a life cycle analysis. I think 3 years ago a life cycle analysis was done at the request of the plastics industry. And that life cycle analysis is quoted over and over again. So recently we made sure that we studied that life cycle analysis, and we found 3 assumptions in it that were erroneous. Those 3 assumptions were that no plastic bags end up as litter. So it was assumed that all plastic bags are either recycled or end up in the municipal waste stream. It was assumed that when a paper bag is replaced with plastic, it only takes 1, maybe 1.5 plastic bags, and the commonly accepted number is more like 3 to 1. And then finally, it was assumed that paper bags are recycled at a rate of 21%, and that actual is now around 60%. So when you reverse those 3 assumptions, you basically find out that up until the point of disposal, paper bags actually generate 59% less greenhouse gas than do plastic bags. And then what's amazing is over the entire life cycle, so from cradle to grave, if you correct the recycling number and you don't assume that that paper bags go to the landfill at a high rate and decompose without oxygen, then they're actually produce less greenhouse gas over the entire life cycle. So a product that decomposes can actually produce less greenhouse gas over a product that is around for hundreds of years.
And, Bill, I need you to wrap up. We have your written testimony.
No, that's fine. In fact, I was able to, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to present some of this information before. So our employees in Beaverton and across Oregon are extremely proud of the environmental performance of our product. We believe that the future for paper bags is going to be the best reusable bag option because at the end of life, it's recycled so readily and so easily that it's going to be the best bag option out there.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And what we're going to do is we're going to have everybody go first, and then we'll take questions. So you 2 minutes, gentlemen. When you go ahead, yes.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gus Gates, Oregon Policy Manager for the Surf Rider Foundation from Florence, and I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come here and provide comments in support of Senate Bill 536. This bill is very important for our membership, and we've been working on this issue for around 4 years now through our Rise Above Plastics initiative. This initiative is focused on raising awareness and educating the citizenry about the impacts of single-use plastic bags in the marine ecosystem, as well as the economic impacts that have been mentioned before so eloquently. And at the same time, we've also been encouraging the use of reusable bags by folks. During this time, we've been doing a lot of beach, highway, and river cleanups. We've distributed about 25,000 reusable bags to volunteers who have participated in those activities, partnered with groups such as Solve. You know, during all these cleanup activities, plastic bags continue to remain a very large component of the trash that we find. And we can do beach, highway, and river cleanups until the end of time. But the fact remains, unless we have some policy changes such as this, we're just going to continue to see the problem go on and on and on. You know, plastic is a major impact to the marine ecosystem and to our waterways here in Oregon because it never biodegrades. It only photodegrades and breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces. And this is an issue because species of concern, aquatic organisms, then consume that, and folks that are fishermen like myself go home and eat fish, and that's a concern. We want to be having a healthy product that is on our dinner plate. So, you know, we're not the only ones that are concerned about this issue. And since you guys first heard about this issue and first addressed it last year, we've been talking with folks around the state, and as I passed out to you guys earlier here, about 475 local businesses from around the state have signed on in support of this bill. These businesses provide local jobs in communities such as Hood River, communities such as Eugene, communities such as Portland, Oregon City, and in Beaverton. But not only there, in Astoria, in Newport, in Lincoln City, in Ashland, in Bend, all throughout this great state of Oregon. And these people recognize the stewardship responsibility that we all have as Oregonians to really make a simple change and reuse reusable bags. In addition to the growing list of businesses that are supportive of this effort, Senator Atkinson mentioned some of the communities that have been supportive of this effort as well. And he did leave a couple off the list, so I think it'd be proper to give credit where credit is due. City of Portland passed a resolution, Metro Regional Government, City of Beaverton, City of Lake Oswego, and I believe Tillamook, Cannon Beach, and Newport were all mentioned as well. So there's a growing list of communities and citizens and businesses that are interested in this issue. And really, it makes a lot of common sense for all of us. And so, you know, in short, we're seeking a policy change to eliminate the use of single-use plastic checkout bags, promote the change and the shift in consumer behavior to bring your own reusable bag. And clearly, a statewide approach is the best solution to the issues associated with plastic bags. And we urge you to do the right thing and move this good piece of legislation forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Murray. I'm Vice President of Business Development for Far West Fibers. As you know, I've been in front of this committee a few times over this issue. It's near and dear to my heart and probably keeps me employed. Far West Fibers operates three major recycling facilities in the Portland metropolitan area. We handle over half the curbside material in the state of Oregon, and we are a strong partner with International Paper and have been for the past 30 years. The paper that we process, of that, about 75% of the brown fiber, which you call cardboard or bags, does go back to IP's mill in Springfield and then reverts back to their Beaverton plants for converting to bags or paper boxes. So it's a very short loop of about 110 miles, I believe. We have a very severe problem with plastic bags, as you're aware, and I'm just stating this for the record. The plastic bags tend to get caught up in what we call our screens in our facilities. The screens are basically discs of different sizes with fingers on them that toss the material around. And over time, the plastic bags tend to get caught up in these discs. They wrap around them. They fill the gaps where the materials, the smaller materials, are supposed to fall. And ultimately, a lot of containers, in particular small pieces of brown fiber, end up going to the newsmill where they're rejected and go off as garbage. It is such a severe problem, it probably causes about 5% to 7% of the curbside material to end up in the wrong, going the wrong direction. Our employees, we have to do what's called a lockout tagout on every break and at the end of every shift, and we run two shifts in each plant every day. 4 to 8 people have to climb onto these screens with box cutter knives and various safety equipment to cut the material out. At times, this may take twice as long as our normal break. We have 20 to 30 people on that line. So bottom line is it costs us nearly a third of our cost to process in that facility is in either pulling bags off the line or getting them out of our equipment. This has become an extreme situation. Of this material, about 65% of it is plastic bags, based on our estimates.
And if you can wrap up.
Yep, the last bit, about 0.5% of what comes into our facility is film plastic bags. Of that, once again, as I said, a third of the cost of sorting is involved with those plastic bags. Thank you.
Great, thank you, gentlemen. Let's see if there's any questions for the panel.
Madam Chair.
Senator House.
I know that you want to get through this hearing, but I do have some questions for a couple of them, and I also think that these three voices here, you know, symbolize, you know, environmentalists, paper manufacturers, and recyclers. Sort of, those are the key components of why we're searching for a solution here. Just for Mr. Gardner, how many paper bags are sold in Oregon, manufactured here? If you can give me kind of the impact of.
Yeah, I didn't bring those numbers. I'll have to get them to you, though.
Okay.
But I could tell you that.
Ballpark.
I could tell you, excuse me?
Just ballpark?
Well, I could tell you that I would suggest that our plant, I would think that our plant in Beaverton probably makes 60 to 70% of all the grocery bags that are used in Oregon.
Thank you. Jeff?
Did you have a follow-up?
Yes.
Yeah.
Follow-up? To.
About to.
Well, a question for Jeff Murray. There was this notion that these plastic grocery bags can be recycled. Obviously, they can't be recycled in the way you do it, and they're not recycled in Oregon. But what does happen? 4% of the $1.7 billion are returned to supermarkets. And what happens to those if they're not recycled?
At this time, the bulk of the bags end up going overseas. They're further sorted in villages, per se. There's probably other higher tech, but the common is that they're sorted by families. Bales are broken apart in that. And then the material is pelletized in very small, I would say, somewhat antiquated facilities that don't necessarily have the same environmental restrictions we may see here.
So, Madam Chair,
follow up.
Not what you would say an environmentally friendly method of reuse?
In the number of, from what I've been told, yes.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. And I think we have your written testimony as well with all your presentation material. So thank you. Senator Ferrioli, you want to come up? And I'm also going to call up Mark Daniels and Roger Vingeline. I'm sorry if I'm not saying that right. So I think you gentlemen came here from Texas. You better watch out because we have an Aggie on the right. on the dais?
You betcha.
Welcome,
we'll
Senator.
We'll talk Texan in a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Ferrioli, Senate District 30. Madam Chairman, I'm here to present the testimony of Jan Kearns, who lives in Haines, Oregon, who is a farmer, a rancher in Baker County, also operates a sustainable farm certified by the Food Alliance. And I'll try to respect your two-minute limitation. Primarily, well, let me say that the committee members already have this testimony in writing, so I won't go through the whole testimony, just to summarize the major concern
that, would be greatly
that I think is at the heart of Jan Kearns' issues, and that is food safety. The interesting thing about these reusable bags is that they get used vigorously by folks who fill them up with perishables, take them home. They may be stored, you know, in a vegetable bin or a rag bag or you know, some mechanism that possibly isn't as sanitary as we'd like to think. I know that I have some that are riding around in the trunk of my car. One of the problems we encounter is that food packaging in grocery stores sometimes doesn't have perfect integrity. I'll use the two words chicken juice to explain what I'm referring to, or the drippings from meat packaging, or any number of contaminants that can get into the webbing of those reusable bags. And one of the things that we know about these bags is that it would be a rare family that would take the bag home, use it, wash it, bleach it, and then put it in a sterile environment in order to return it to the store. I've had an experience I think you may all have had. I use caffeine. You know, I sometimes stop at the little kiosks to get my, you know, my daily grind. And occasionally I will try to pass back a used coffee cup into the store that sells, you know, beverages to go. They will refuse to accept, you know, not only that used coffee cup, but any packaging that's been touched by or handled by or used by the consuming public, because they're terrified that cross-contamination could put them at liability for foodborne pathogens and financial liability if somebody gets sick. Well, the same thing applies to these reusable bags. They're great conveniences and so on and so forth, but unless they're sterilized with each use and stored in a sterile environment, there is a danger of transferring foodborne pathogens, including E. coli, listeria, and any number of nasty things that grow, you know, in the dark and moist environments where there have been some sort of contaminants available. That, I'm afraid, is the problem with this mandate, is that today people have a choice. You can get a single-use bag. It can be paper or plastic. It's the cost of those things are being absorbed by the consumer, built into the price structure of the grocery stores. And people have the choice. You know, I think the most ubiquitous thing you'll hear at a checkout stand is paper or plastic. At the end of the day, folks have the choice to use those products. We shouldn't necessarily be arguing about the benefits of paper versus plastic. The bottom line is we should be arguing about how do we keep Oregon's food supply safe and protected from cross-contamination. And until there's a mechanism to deliver a sterile bag, or to take bags that the consumer brings and exchange them for a sterile bag, or a processing facility in the grocery stores that will sterilize these bags, we shouldn't be encouraging people to bring things that could be contaminated with pathogens into the store, touch them with their hands, where the consumer touches the produce or the meat products, and then you know, sort of recycles that bacteria through the system. That, Madam Chairman, is the principal concern, food safety, that Mrs. Kearns asked me to present to the committee today.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Let me see if there's any questions.
Was that longer than 2 minutes?
It was just a little bit, but it's okay. I'm going to subtract it from their time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But let's see if there's any questions before we let the Senator go. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair,
all right,
for your
thank you.
Consideration today.
Thanks for coming and sharing Ms. Kearns' testimony.
And the committee has
we have the written one.
The volume of testimony. Thank
great.
You.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, I do want to welcome the men from Texas here. And with a token of appreciation from Oregon, I have for you sort of a
thank you for coming and engaging us in this debate. These are reusable bags. Thank you for being here.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Haas.
All right, gentlemen. And we do have your written testimony, so again, I'm going to just ask to summarize.
I will try and cut this down because I'm sure it was more than 2 minutes. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Mark Daniels, and I'm the Vice President of Sustainability and Environmental Policy for Hilux Poly.
And you're located in
We are located. We have 9 manufacturing facilities throughout the United States. We're an American-based company. We are a manufacturer of plastic bags made from recycled materials and operator of the world's largest closed-loop plastic bag recycling facility. In an effort to be brief, there are 3 primary reasons why we oppose Senate Bill 536. First, the bags that we manufacture are fully recyclable. They are made with natural gas. In the United States, while the bags that this bill is intended to promote, these reusable bags, are also plastic bags. They're non-woven polypropylene bags. They are made in China from foreign oil, and they have their environmental issues. As a senator talked about before, there are cross-contamination issues that have to be concerned of. And recent reports in the USA Today and in the San Francisco Chronicle have documented that there's high levels of toxic lead in several of these reusable bags, which is of concern. Secondly, SB 536 imposes a multi-million dollar tax on Oregon shoppers. Does it benefit the taxpayers of Oregon?
If I may interrupt, we have got a legal opinion that says it's not a tax. We've got a legal opinion. It doesn't require that 3/5 vote in this chamber. So if you want to keep referring to it, I love seeing a hearing room full of people engaged in this. Let's play within the rules.
Okay.
And you stick to the facts. That's all I'm asking.
There's a minimum of a 5-cent fine on a consumer that has to buy a paper bag as opposed to bringing in a harmful reusable bag. Third, our company and this industry are leaders in American manufacturing and recycling. We believe that more recycling rather than a banning a safe and legal product should be the focus of this committee. You know, we recognize to date that we have not effectively separated fact from fiction or highlighted the industry's sustainability efforts. Our goal today is to try and change that and have a fact-based conversation with you about the issue. For background, our company has 1,250 associates throughout the nation and is part of an industry that employs 10,000 Americans. There are thousands of other jobs that provide products and services to this important American-based industry. This committee's decision on the proposed 536 will impact more than 40,000 families supported by the plastic bag industry. While we don't have a manufacturing facility in Oregon, your decision on this ban will impact thousands of American jobs, something we believe you would be sensitive to given that Oregon and our nation's high unemployment rate. Hilux is a leader in recycling technology and a major recycler of used plastic bags and wraps. We operate the world's largest closed-loop plastic bag recycling facility. We support 75 new green jobs in this business, and we will recycle in excess of 25 million pounds this year alone. We have more than 30,000 recycling bins placed at grocery stores, churches, and schools throughout the nation, many of which are in Oregon. You have take-back programs at many retailers because this is a dynamic and profitable market. That's why we hope you will consider working with ways to support and grow and expand recycling rather than passing an ill-conceived ban with unintended consequences. As I said, recent news stories have pointed out that many of these bags contain high levels of toxic lead. Since consumers have no way of distinguishing which bags have lead and which bags don't, everybody is at risk. You know, furthermore, even the bags that don't contain lead are hazardous, as the senator spoke to before. You know, so we look at this as, you know, what kind of a choice is this? Forcing consumers either to pay the fee or on paper bags or place themselves in harm's way with these hidden consequences of reusable bags. Our plastic shopping bags, on the other hand, offer the consumers a safe, recyclable, convenient, and sanitary checkout option. Given our industry's positive economic impact as well as leadership and innovation in recycling, we urge the committee to consider a better option than 536, and we stand ready to work with you to do so. So thank you very much for your time as we talk about these facts.
Okay, thank you. And since I didn't realize you were from the same company, so if you do you have anything additional that you'd like to add?
For
the record, your name.
Okay, excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Binglin.
I'm a Portland resident, and I'm a Western Area Sales Manager for Hilux Poly. I have a couple things to add that Mark didn't talk about. First, our product is often referred to as a single-use product and or disposable, and that is incorrect. Studies in California and Seattle and even here in the state of Oregon verify that 9 out of 10 Americans reuse plastic bags for either trash can liners or pet waste or many other uses. There's an economic benefit to Oregonians for this, and that is that they do not have to buy other bags or other plastic bags to use for these products. This phenomenon is exemplified by a past plastic bag tax that was passed in Ireland. Did the number of plastic grocery bags that were used diminish? Yes, it did. But what is not mentioned is the fact that that the purchase of heavier, larger plastic trash bags increased by more than 400% during that time. In terms of litter, we all hate litter. But to put it the littered plastic bags into perspective, there are several studies, Florida, Texas, Washington, San Francisco, Seattle, among others, that document plastic shopping bags litter is less than 1% of the items that are littered. It's also often reported that that this litter ends up in the Great Pacific Ocean garbage patch and killing hundreds of thousands of marine mammals. This myth was challenged by NOAA, and they state, and I'll quote this, we were able to find no information to support this statement. An erroneous statement attributing these figures to plastic bags was published in 2002 report published by the Australian government. It was corrected in 2006. Additionally, Oregon State University recently published a study about the garbage patch, and according to the study, the patch is hyperbole and an exaggeration that drives a wedge between public and scientific community. So simply put, Senate Bill 536 would ban a convenient, 100% recyclable, and 100% reusable, sanitary, and safe plastic bag made in America by Americans and encourages the use of a plastic product, this one, that is made in China with foreign oil.
Sir, if you can wrap up.
I will. I'll wrap up right now. Furthermore, Senate Bill 536 imposes a fee that is not collected by the government to provide better schools or better quality health for Oregonians, but it is a fee collected by the grocery industry for the grocery industry with no limit on what that fee might be.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
We'll
see if there's some questions. Senator Hess.
You know, I think Oregonians would love to recycle your bags. They really would. And if they could, we wouldn't be here today. The whole point of the recyclers being in support of this is because they can't recycle your bags. 4% are turned into the supermarkets sent over to China. You just heard that testimony. If Oregon recyclers could recycle your bags, there would be no need for this. We want to be able to recycle them, but we can't. And so they don't get recycled, and they do end up in the beaches and in the ocean. And you keep referring to these things as being recyclable. And I want to caution you on that, because I think you're stretching things when you say these are recycled, when in fact 96% of them are not in this state.
Well, with respect, 60% of them are being reused for another item. And it may be pet waste pickup. It may be to line a trash can. When that happens, we only have about a 40% population of products that can be recycled. The EPA has documented in their latest figures that 13% of plastic bags and wraps are recycled. So when you do the math of the 13% over the 40%, we're at 35% recycling rate. We have a 73% reuse and recycling rate. This is the factual things. We have studies that we can send to you, Senator. That's why we wanted to sit here and appreciate the fact that we can talk about the true facts that are cited. The 4% is very low. That's just not a factual figure, I'm sorry, I'm afraid.
And by the way, anything that you follow up, if you can cite where the sources are, it would be helpful.
Yes, we'd be happy to.
Senator Hess, did you have a follow-up? Okay, other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Daniels. The green bags, what are they made of again?
Those are non-woven polypropylene plastic bags.
And the white paper, or white T-shirt bags, if you will?
That's a high molecular weight, high density polyethylene bag.
So they're similar in makeup. Will these biodegrade in the landfill?
No, they will not. There's no recycling for non-woven polypropylene.
So if we remove the plastic bags from the market and everyone goes to these bags and we have a food safety issue and they dispose of the bag, we have no resource to recycle them. They will end up in a landfill.
They will. As a matter of fact, there were, in the past 4 years, according to the harmonized code for the reusable bags, in excess of 2 billion have already been imported into the United States in the last 2 years.
Thank you.
4 years, excuse me.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Przanski.
Thank you. Mr. Daniels, what part of Texas?
I live in Plano, Texas.
In Plano, good. I'm from Texas. San Antonio is where I was raised, and found out that this was the Northwest, was kind of where we wanted to be. So I did have, it was interesting when Senator Hasp wanted to show you the bags and stuff like that. I just happen to have one in my office that's similar, but I assume you know about HEB.
I do know HEB, certainly.
And I assume your store is probably, or your company actually provides that store with your plastic bags.
We are not recently a manufacturer for HEB. We have in the past.
All right. So and could you tell me why? Has they gone to a different product that may be more recyclable?
No, they went through what's called a reverse auction and chose to buy bags that were less expensive than the ones that we put our bid in for, quite simply.
All right. So do you know out here in Oregon, one of the things that stores will do is actually give credit for people bringing their own bags in, 5 cents a bag, credit off your, if you bring in your own cloth bag or if you bring in some other type of takeout bag. Is that practice used in Texas anywhere?
That practice was used by, I believe, Target stores in Texas. I know that in, like, New Jersey, ShopRite offers 2 cents to bring back a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
That is a market solution that could... We are a company that believes in consumer choice. Our legislators in our neighboring state where we have a plant in Jerome, Idaho, we have not asked them to ban paper bags in Oregon. Nor would we ever do that. We are not asking for a ban on reusable bags. We would not do that. We would like to see better protocols on their safekeeping and public education on the fact that they have to be washed and make sure there's protocols that don't allow lead in here. But we're not asking for a ban of a product. We think if a person wants to use, I use paper bags. I put my newspapers in when I recycle that. I really like plastic bags because they hold a lot more. They don't, you know, when it's raining out, I can carry 8 bags at one time. And I recycle them, and I reuse them because I have 2 dogs, and, you know, we have bathrooms. So we think a consumer should have a choice for what kind of product they can use to bring groceries out of a store or, you know, out of a retail establishment.
You made a comment earlier about, you made a comment earlier about considering the 5 cent being a tax. Do you know that Oregon also is the was the founder in the bottle bill? That has a requirement of a 5 cent tax as your
well,
under your definition.
Well, is that not more of a deposit where a consumer can bring that bottle back and he or she receives that nickel back? So that's a deposit. This right. is whether we can have it as a fee or a tax or a fine. It is still, you know, that person that has to buy 10 paper bags because he or she didn't bring a reusable bag in. That 50 cents, or like I said, that was just the floor. Maybe it's a dollar. That could have been used to buy apples or produce or something else other than paying for something that was given to them, and that goes to the grocers. It doesn't go to any social program in your state.
Right. So let me ask you about cloth bags. What's your position and your company's position on use of cloth bags for as a reusable bag?
Again, if the market wants to supply a cloth bag, you know, now, again, are we distinguishing a cloth bag from a non-woven polypropylene bag?
Yes, one. Natural fiber.
I think a natural fiber bag, as long as it's washed. We know the natural fiber bags will not have any toxins in them, which I think is a very good thing. They need to be washed frequently, if not after every use, just for the protection of health. We have no objection to those kinds of products.
Have you ever used a paper bag in bringing it back to get something at a retail facility in your own
I'm sorry, have I used a paper bag and brought
right.
it back for recycling or something? No.
To actually reuse?
Where I live, paper bags can, you know, go into the recycling stream, the single stream. That's why we've distinguished, you know, to the point of the gentleman that was talking about the recycling program for the MRFs, that's why we have separated the recycling stream for store take-back programs, because we get a very clean stream. We get 90% what's called a rate of return, if you will, on this thing. We of the 100% that comes in, we reprocess 90% of it into new polyethylene products that go into plastic bags remanufactured.
Mr. Daniels, regarding the sanitation, it's really concerned me. I've heard one of the things that Mr. Daniels and I forget Mr.
Bingler
said something about the concern about sanitation and bringing in foreign products. I mean, I personally and my wife, we have used bags, either plastic bags or paper bags or cloth bags multiple times by taking them into the store, having refilled. In fact, the ones that she would be selling for produce back in and put more produce into those same bags. So you're telling me that I am subject to having some type of contamination that's will occur and infect my food?
All I can say is the study that was done by the University of Arizona that found that 50% of the bags had either E. coli, salmonella, or other bacteria, mold, and yeast in 50% of the bags.
And do you know who paid for that study?
That was done by the American Chemistry Council, but it was done by Dr. Gerba, who is a world-renowned microbiologist.
Right, and the American Chemical Council is, how do they play into this plastic bag?
The American Chemistry Council, there is a division within the American Chemistry Council called the Progressive Bag Affiliates, which is an industry association that wants to try and get to the facts.
We do have somebody here signed up to testify from them.
Okay. Anyway. I want to appreciate you coming in, but at the same time, we talk about wanting to not have exaggeration. I mean, you're basically telling everyone that's listening today here in this room that they're at risk as to using or reusing a bag, be it paper, be it plastic, or being some type of natural fiber by bringing it back in the stores. And I've heard that same argument about how we used to have the recycling of bottles, bringing the bottles back. And I guess to date I've not seen where anyone's gotten sick or had any issues from that. And so unless you've got studies that actually have been shown that people are actually getting sick by that process, I'd like to have that information made available to me.
We will certainly get you the study that was done by the University of Arizona. Absolutely.
As well as who, and how much do they pay for that study?
I really couldn't say.
I'd like to know how much that was, because it seems like they bought the study, and since that they paid for it, and that they're here actually in opposition to the to this bill, then it makes it suspect to me as to how valid the study really is.
Madam Chair, point of clarification.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Senator Brzezinski brings up a very good point on recycling. I would defer, though, that bottles, when they're returned, are cleaned by the manufacturer before reusing, whereas a consumer most likely would not take these bags home and clean them himself or themselves. And tin cans that are recycled are crushed and remelted and reapplied into the product. So a comparison there, I think, is a little bit over the line.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
As chair, though, I get the last question. Chair's prerogative.
Okay.
Just point of clarification, you had mentioned that you don't have any manufacturing facilities here in Oregon. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you don't have
Our closest one is in Jerome, Idaho.
Okay, so you don't have any Oregonians employed in manufacturing of plastic bags?
Well, we would certainly like to investigate, and you know, this is we hope to have the opportunity to speak with the committee further about this. We would love to invest in the state of Oregon, but it would be on the recycling side, because we would love a West Coast presence on the recycling, building the recycling infrastructure of plastic bags and wraps. But bills like this certainly just put a grinding halt to creativity and investment in the state.
And a follow-up to that, because I've been working on recycling issues for 25-plus years, how much money does your company invest in recycling facilities? In other words, we hear about these programs at different grocery stores, and you heard today from one of the top, as you heard, they basically deal with over 50% of recyclables in Oregon. How much is your industry investing in making sure that plastic bags are actually recycled versus, as we heard, being exported to countries like China where they're not being handled in an environmentally sensitive way?
Madam Chair, I can't speak for the entire industry. We have invested, since 2005, about $25 million in plant and equipment. We've added 72 green jobs for the recycling of these plastic things, and then plastic bags and wraps. And we have also invested a significant amount of money in the donation of the and the distribution of the bins. Those bins, as I said earlier, we've distributed about 30,000 of them. They go anywhere from $30 to $60. So a lot of that material that we've gone out to provide those bins out into the marketplace so consumers can have that logistics avenue for the recycling of these products. Our plan is to go from 25 million pounds to 100 million pounds in the next several years, and we want to do that with joint ventures, and we will invest well into multi-million dollars to be able to do that if we can have, you know, this product survive based on facts that we hope that we're listening to in this particular committee.
And one last point of clarification and that I heard in your testimony, you were concerned about losing American jobs. My sense is that you didn't take into account any growth in jobs if, for instance, paper bag manufacturing was being increased. So you were just talking about in the plastic bag manufacturing. I just heard concern about loss of American jobs, but obviously,
well,
if there were more paper bags being used, then there'd be a growth in jobs in a different sector.
Granted, but you're asking Oregonians to pay something for a paper bag. So there's some agreement that paper bags are not so great for the environment, and the bill is geared to manufacturing these bags, of which, as again, 95% are manufactured overseas. This is, you know, as we talked about before, this is a plastic product, but it's still stitched, right? And the issue is the labor costs, and that's why these bags are manufactured in Asian countries, predominantly China. So, yes, there will be job loss with this. It's in the plastic industry. I can't speak for the paper industry. To try and force behavior of consumers is always a risky proposition. I don't know how many more paper bags are going to be reused and what that greenhouse gas means. When we ship one truckload of these bags, seven truckloads of paper bags have to be shipped for the same amount. So there are some issues with regards to paper bags. But, again, we prefer in consumer choice for a carry-out product.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Yes.
One follow-up from yours.
Yep. And then we'll move on to the next panel. Yeah.
Mark, regarding your company, did I understand that you actually are recycling these bags actually in the U.S.?
Yes.
And if so, where?
Every one of our manufacturing facility has recycling equipment. The Greenfield plant that we built in Indiana does a triple wash and shredding of this material, as well as garment bag, newspaper bags, bottle, tissue, towel, overwraps. So we wash and reprocess that. That's the facility that'll do 25 million pounds.
Right. So why are these bags then being shipped to China to be processed versus being in your facility?
It's a market that's in and of itself. The recycling market, according to the latest statistics for 2009, 720 million pounds of plastic bags and wraps were recycled. Much of that is maintained in the United States with companies like Trex, which makes composite lumber, or AERT, or manufacturers like Hancock that make plastic piping for sewerage and things like that. But it's a worldwide market. People from, you know, companies from China would like to buy this material and reprocess it for their own purposes. But, you know, we play in that marketplace. We're paying market price, which today is anywhere from 17 to 20 cents a pound. You know, maybe in China they're paying 18 to 22 cents a pound, and a retailer says, I'm going to make that extra 2 cents and send it overseas. I can't control that other than participate in the marketplace. But we do buy 25 million pounds of this material and reprocess it.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank
for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for coming here today. So we have many more folks that want to come up, and we're going to keep calling folks up from far away. And next we have is there anybody else from away on the four list? Okay. So we're going to go back to, we're sort of alternating sign-up sheets here. We have Joe Gilliam, Melinda Merrill, and Dan Floyd. And also, we had a request, since the Department of Environmental Quality is here, so I'm going to call them up afterwards, because one of the pieces of information that was missing was the percentage of plastics that's being recycled here in Oregon. And so I thought for the committee it'd be important to have that information. So whoever wants to start off, we've got the clock going. We're trying. I think we'll be here till about 6, so, you know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam. I beg your pardon for missing the sanitation testimony. I was out counting bottles and cans.
That's a different hearing, Joe.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're on bags today, is that correct?
Bags, right. Yeah.
Interesting testimony. Where were they in 2007?
Germane to this,
anyway.
Yeah.
We're here today in favor of the Senate bill. I want to welcome everybody who's testified against the bill to 2006. That's where we started. We argued about which bag is better, which bag is worse, my bag, your bag, this bag, that bag. This bill is about 5 years of hard work between industry, consumers, bag makers, particularly cities and local jurisdictions that had a desire to regulate the bags. And really what is important to the grocery industry is the fact that we'd have a statewide policy as cities and counties look at different ideas from banning to taxing. We could end up with a patchwork that's not only city to city, but you could have a ban in some area or a two-layered or three-layered tax in some areas. Consumers wouldn't have a consistent shopping experience no matter where they go because everybody could be doing their own thing. Just banning the bags is very, very costly. The plastic bag is cheap. The paper bag is more expensive. There are good and bad parts of either bag. But when we came down to it, we weighed all the different areas and all the different issues. There is no silver bullet, I'm here to tell you, on bags. But to try to find a system that would work, it's very imperative that is a statewide policy. Now, if you want to go back 5 years, we can, and we can start arguing which bag is better, which is what we've heard so far. But the most important thing for the grocery industry is a statewide policy that can be adhered to, that we can distribute to, that we can give our consumers a consistent form and what they should expect when they go into any retail store. Now, we don't believe any system should have a way of costing the grocery stores from the cost shift from plastic to paper. So that's why the nickel's in there. It is not a profit center. I've been kind of laughing today as I've heard the rhetoric around the Capitol that I'm trying to pass a windfall profit measure. I always say the best way to do that is to hold a hearing and try to pass a law. You'll fool everybody. There's no secret here. A bag costs 5 cents. That's all the nickel is for. And to give every retailer a level playing field so your small independent grocer is on the same level as a big box Walmart down the street, that no matter where the consumer goes, they have a consistent level playing field for the purpose of reducing plastic and the policy of trying to use more reusable bags, including paper. If you don't like the fabric bag that's here, this gives a cheap alternative at the register rather than buying another dollar bag, buying a nickel bag, and reusing that or putting it in curbside because it will recycle a curbside. So those are our main concerns, and I'll take any questions. You have retailers that are sitting here to my right that may have more information.
Would you like to testify or here for questions?
I'll testify. Dan Floyd with Safeway, Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations. Joe hit on most of my points, but if I could prioritize anything and tell you anything, I want to talk about how far-reaching Safeway is and how many communities we do touch in Oregon. The Portland Division has 116 stores. In Oregon, we operate 100 stores, 12,000 employees. In all of your districts, we have a distribution center, just like our competitor here in Clackamas County. So we are all over
the place. Notice
you
didn't say their name.
The other guys.
Yeah, she will. And so compliance with all the local ordinances would be extremely difficult. And with us in every single one of those communities that are talking about bag policy right now, it would impact all of our stores. Excuse me. So if I could stress anything, a statewide law is the way to go. That's what we need. I appreciate the fact that you've brought this forward. And you're talking about a legislation that actually has a goal of moving consumers to reusable bags. A lot of the other policies we've seen don't do that. This does. So we appreciate that, and I just want to thank you for that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Melinda Merrill, Director of Public Affairs for Fred Meyer Stores. I've resubmitted the testimony that our President Mike Ellis gave to you in December, which contains a lot of great information about our sort of test, removing plastic bags from 10 of our Portland stores. Of course, I can only ditto what Joe and Dan said about the need for a statewide law, because the patchwork will be so expensive and difficult for us to execute and execute accurately. And the other thing is that you'll see in the testimony, when we pull plastic out of our stores, everyone shifts to paper. Our paper usage goes up more than double, and that means those costs go up more than double. And in addition to the costs, you're shifting the problem from one disposable bag to another. So I get that a lot of people think there's more important things to deal with this session. I understand that this isn't what a lot of people want to see in terms of government having a hand in our lives, but this is something we need. It will protect jobs. It will protect our economy. I can't think of what the economic impacts can be for the proponents that add up to when you talk about doubling the usage of paper bags in the stores with the flip of a switch. So appreciate you considering this and bringing this forward and moving it on. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
Ms. Merrill, you said that when you eliminated plastic bags, you doubled the use of paper bags. What other resource would they have to carry food home in?
They have the reusable bags, and those are available. We have two different sizes available. We have boxes in some of our stores that are available. So the reusable bag usage also increased, I think, maybe 8 or 9%. But it was paper that everyone shifted to because that's the one that's free right now.
Follow-up?
Yes. Ms. Merrill, how many stores does Fred Meyer's have in Oregon?
50.
50 stores? How many are in the Portland metro area?
There's 10 that are in this test that we removed plastic bags from. There's 10 in the city of Portland. Portland metro, however you define that, probably 30 or so.
Okay. Mr.
Follow-up?
I'll learn.
It's okay. One senator already Blue. Wasn't, so we'll just take care of them later.
Mr. Floyd, you have 116 stores. Mr. Floyd, do you have 116 stores in Oregon?
100 stores in Oregon.
100 stores in Oregon.
Yes.
And how many in the Portland metro area?
The entire Portland, Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah County, about 45 stores.
45 stores, okay.
That would include Canby, Oregon City soon.
Follow-up? When you ship regular groceries to these stores, does each store take the same quantity of groceries, saved tomato soup?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, Senator Olson. So you're asking if, when we ship groceries to the store, does each store take the same amount of, quantity of groceries?
My point being is you say it would be difficult to have a hodgepodge of some stores that get paper bags, some stores that get plastic bags, or plastic bags, paper bags combination. Question being then, let me put it another way, do some of your stores carry products that the other lines of your stores don't, like a superstore?
Madam
Chair,
I can get in here too.
Go ahead.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, Joe really wants to get in here, but I got to stop him. of course, we have different items in different stores. You look at the Portland metropolitan area, for instance, multiple counties, we have metro, we have varying cities. You're going to go from county to county in a real big hurry. You're going to go from city to city in a big hurry. And if we have local ordinances that are all over the map like they are right now, we're going to be talking about tax, we're talking about a fee, talking about a ban on one thing, talking about a ban on plastic, maybe not paper. It's confusing and costly for the customer and the retailer.
Okay. Follow up.
Mr. Gilliam.
Yes.
If I walked into a Safeway in Canby or walked into a Safeway in Astoria, why would it be confusing for me if I got a plastic bag or a paper bag?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you may walk in and get a tax in one area, or you might have it banned in another. You might have any different number of policies that could be layered from city or county. If you're in the metro area, you could have three layers of policies. Depending on whether you're in Gresham or crossing over into Troutdale, or you're in Wood Village, and it's not a good thing for the consumer. It's obviously, if we're trying to comply with every law that may have three different layers in the metro area, it is a distribution nightmare and extremely costly for the grocer to make sure they're paying the county tax, the city tax, and the metro tax, or a combination of taxes and bans, whatever they might come up with on these bags. We have been at this 5 years with all those proposals on the table. Most of those proposals require a tax that just funds government. So the bags are still there. It's just a matter of funding. City of Seattle tried it at 20 cents a bag, and it was going to fund seven FTEs in the city of Seattle in their environmental division. That's what the purpose of the tax was. So everybody starts going all over the place on this. One thing we've agreed on over 5 years of discussions is that the common goal was that the plastic bags, you can't deny it, you can't argue against it, they're a litter problem. And the plastic bag industry, I don't know whether they could, but if they can, they haven't done enough to address litter. We've done all the recycling in our stores. Grocery is the only one who's done it voluntarily. We've done it at our cost, our labor, and we've got to a point to say it doesn't work anymore. It's too expensive for the consumer, and the one thing we agree on is reducing that, and that's what you're seeing in this bill. So it's not like we're willy-nilly and we just, you know, this is some hidden deal. This is a long time coming, and what's very frustrating in this process is to have groups like the Americans for Prosperity and things like that putting out data and emails and all this stuff, and they haven't been at the table. They haven't been at one city council meeting at 9:30 discussing this over the last 5 years. This is not haphazard. So for industry to be sitting up here and agreeing on one common point to do the right thing is a huge opportunity for the state of Oregon.
Follow up.
Mr. Uliam, when were plastic bags first introduced?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, they started about 30 years ago, came into the marketplace. Technology created a very cheap, inexpensive bag that could be produced very quickly.
And was it also sold to reduce the use of forest products to make paper bags?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it didn't sell very well in Oregon at the time. In fact, probably irritated a lot of folks. In fact, back in, I think it was 1979 session, we have a very little-known statute on the book right now. It's hard to find. It's terrible to find, but it basically was put in by the paper bag industry that said, if you offer a plastic bag, you must offer a paper bag. And that's where the question comes, paper or plastic at the register. Mm-hmm. Now, there is compliance problems with that in this day and age as you've moved down the, you know, 30 years down the line.
Follow up? Mr. Gilliam, your proposal then would be to make paper bags. Where would we get the resources for the paper bags?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, almost 100% of the material that comes from, that makes paper bags, comes from either product waste from making other products. You don't go out and cut virgin trees to make paper. You get it from mill-ins and construction lumber and all other products like that. The other component of it is other paper fiber, and that paper fiber goes to the system around seven times until it dissipates to a point that it's no longer usable. So you're going to get it from the paper that exists and byproducts from other timber processing.
Okay, how about the last one?
One more. Mr. Gilliam, since we are, our state is moving towards biomass, and we are also undercutting or underutilizing our forests. I'm in the construction industry, and we don't have a lot of 2x4s being made now. Do you foresee us running out of raw material to make paper bags? And if we do, where would we get the supply?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have any idea how much wood is out there, how much paper fiber is out there. You could ask the paper, International Paper is up here, but I don't want to give you some bogus answer because I have
we'll
no
ask
idea
them to
what's this.
Follow up on that, Mr. Vice Chair. Okay.
Thank you
any
very
other
much.
Questions? Okay, Senator Thompson, been awfully quiet down there.
Yeah, absorbing a lot. Chair Dean-Diller, thank you. Just my quick question. In all the discussions that you guys have had with the major grocers and come up with a nickel, the nickel per paper bag. The smaller stores, the little hardware stores, the little grocery stores, that nickel, I'm just assuming that you buy so many bags, the more you buy, the cheaper the product, the cheaper the bag.
Was there a discussion in there about what you guys might get a little comparative advantage compared to the smaller stores? What was the discussion there?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, we came to the price of a general kind of surveying of people what they pay, small stores, independent stores, and the chains. To be quite honest with you, we are very careful when we talk as a group about anything about price and anything about costs of bags because it's competitive.
Right.
But talking to independents and chains separately and through there, it's about 4 to 6 cents for a bag, the just traditional box style paper grocery bag you've used for years. So the nickel is splitting it in the middle. That bag cost could go up because there's a large tax credit that was in the paper bag industry for the way they burn their fuel. That is going away. It's a very large one. It could affect the price of bags. So we're, in the future, the price of bag goes up to 8 cents. A grocer has to take his chances in the marketplace and try to cover his costs. Probably not going to happen if the lower floor is 5 cents. They're always going to stay, try to be competitive.
Okay, my vice chair has one last question, and then he promised that would be it.
Either Mr. Floyd or Ms. Merrill can answer this question. When the consumer goes in and purchases their groceries, have you thought of the logistics of do you have a counter of the bags, or do you load the grocery cart, and does the teller then turn around and count all the bags and add that final cost on at the end? And what if you double bag? Is that 10 cents?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we have actually talked quite a bit about the logistics of it and haven't come to a solution, but we're thinking there could be a barcode on the bag that scans. Yes, the cashier can count them. That's been a topic that we've talked about for years as people talk about charging per plastic bag. They already give you a 5 cent refund for your reusable bag, so they're already counting those reusable bags. It's a lot easier to overcome than some of the alternatives without this.
Okay.
Senator
Olson.
I just want to respond to this.
Yes.
Senator Olson was wondering alternative fibers. We did pass a bill called industrial hemp. We can always bring back the industrial hemp industry.
I knew there was going to be some self-promotion here on this one. All right, thank you very much. And very pleased to see both of my, I have both Safeway and Fred Meyer's in my district.
Thank you.
Here.
As do
thank
I.
For coming. Yes, most of us. Okay, I have asked the Department of Environmental Quality to come up to respond. There was a request from one of the members about the statistics in Oregon. And then we have Tim Shestick, Bill Huffman, and Josh Cooling up next. This is sort of like batting, you get up on the, who's coming up next. Okay. Welcome, Palmer.
All right. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I want to tell you the numbers I have may not directly answer the question of how many plastic bags, single-use checkout plastic bags are recycled. We don't have that type of information, so I'll do my best to provide you with what I've got, and I'll certainly take any questions that you have. The other thing that I have to tell you is these numbers are 2005, so they're dated numbers. I believe I may be able to get more recent numbers. They'll either be 2007, 2009 numbers, and I will certainly report back to the committee on that. But the numbers I have with me today are 2005, so I just want to put that caveat out there. And I'm going to talk about film plastic. Film plastic is, or single-use checkout bags are a type of film plastic, but it's not the only type of film plastic. The bags that you buy your bread in is another film plastic, that type of thing. So I just want to paint the picture for you. When it comes to film plastic, we estimate that there's about 96,000 tons of film plastic in Oregon's waste stream. Now that includes
that per year.
Per year, that's an annual number. Again,
1,000 tons per year.
Yes, 96,000 tons. That's again a 2005 number.
Mm-hmm.
That includes agricultural, commercial, and residential film plastics. We estimate that about 30% of that film plastic would be potentially recyclable, and 70% would not. Again, I don't have a reliable number for the amount of plastic bags that are actually disposed of in the waste stream. Then you go a little deeper, and then you ask how much or what's the percentage using those 2005 numbers of the film plastic that's actually recycled. And we estimate that it's about 11.6%. I want you to note, though, that a lot of that recycled material is going to come from commercial and agricultural plastics, not the residential plastics, which would include the single-use checkout bag. And so the best I can say in terms of a recycling rate for plastic bags is going to be obviously somewhat lower than 11.6 number, but I can't give you a definitive number.
Okay. Thank you, Palmer. And if you hold on, I'll take questions in a minute, but if you have more recent numbers, could you please make sure and email that to the committee? The other is, do you have national data? I'm curious how we compare nationally.
I can follow up on that, okay. Chair Dingfelder.
Senator Hess?
Thanks. I just want to confirm, Palmer, that your department supports this legislation, and if you could, there was somebody alluded to the lead in some of these bags. Could you tell us that story and complete the picture?
Yes, I will certainly try to do that, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hass. The question was, I think, whether there are heavy metals in reusable bags. And I don't want to present the DEQ as an expert on this issue, but our folks did look at that since it was raised in the course of preparing for this hearing. And the studies we have seen show that you find lead and other heavy metals in single-use bags as well as reusable bags. And it doesn't seem to us that reusable bags contain any more lead or heavy metals than single-use bags. And in fact, some of the studies suggest that it's actually the opposite, that the higher concentrations of heavy metals, things like lead, tend to be in the single-use bags as opposed to the reusable bags. But again, I don't want to present that we've done an exhaustive study, but I did ask some of our scientists and folks to go and look, and that is what they came back with.
And Palmer, if you can follow up with that, citing studies that they found, I think that would be helpful.
Well, I have the study here.
You can just email it to us.
Okay, I can.
That'd be good. So we have it, and as our members want to dig deeper into this, they can look at that themselves. Right. Any other questions for the department?
Yes.
I figured you would. Let's go to this side first. That's and fine. See if anybody on this end. Okay. My vice chair.
Go ahead. Mr. Palmer, has DEQ done any or taken any efforts to improve recycling of single-use bags or T-shirt bags, if you will?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that's not something that we have a regular program dedicated to. We certainly have programs that encourage people to recycle more, and there are some efforts, as has been noted in this testimony, to recycle single-use checkout bags, but it's not anything that the department has singled out as a high priority, if that answers your question.
Follow up. If this is an issue where we want to ban a product from the state of Oregon and DEQ deals with recycling and you knew this issue was coming up, could I assume that one should have looked at maybe a potential program to recycle these bags?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, I think that would certainly be a reasonable question. I can tell you why we haven't focused on it. Our efforts in waste management have tried to focus on waste prevention. And that is the idea that rather than create the waste and then deal with it after that product has run its useful life, let's try to find ways to reduce the waste generation in the first place. And that is one reason why we have been suggesting that the use of reusable bags is such a good idea. It generates the waste, you know, from being created in the first instance. And we tend to find that that has the highest environmental benefit.
All right, thank you. And also, Senator Olson, just to be fair, most of the recycling programs are run at the local level. The state does provide guidance. The state itself does not run the recycling programs. We are going to hear from Metro, who's here, that does run regional recycling programs. So just wanted to clarify that. Okay? Thank you, Palmer, for coming up. Appreciate it. And we're going to have Mr. Sestick. Sorry, I'm not very good with names today. Josh Culling and Bill Huffman. I'll be right back. 2 minutes.
Where is it? Madam Chair,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Shestick with the American Chemistry Council. Let me just say that I'm in violent agreement with my good friend Joe Gilliam. If we're going to limit this bill just to the preemption provision, I think we might be out of here pretty quickly. But let me just say that we are opposed to this bill not because we don't believe more can and should be done to reduce litter and waste. But frankly, in our view, this approach is not the solution. A lot of the comments that I was going to make were made by Mr. Daniels earlier, but let me just clarify a couple of points. When my member companies talk about a recycling solution, we're talking about programs that are established primarily at retail stores, but at other locations where consumers can bring back bags and other film plastics for recycling purposes. Those programs are, in fact, working. And I would agree with Mr. Murray that when products come through the MRF sorting line, plastic bags and film, they do cause problems. That's why we're supportive of efforts to ensure that those bags are brought back to drop-off locations where they're clean and marketable. There is a market for this material. Companies are buying the material. And to suggest that just because a company is located in the Far East who is purchasing and exporting recyclables from the United States, that's not necessarily recycling, I would beg to differ. Not just plastics, but a variety of other materials are exported primarily from the West Coast to the Far East for recycling purposes. And I would contend that I find it difficult that somebody would actually purchase material, ship it all the way to the Far East, and then not use that as feedstock for other materials. So we have been supportive of recycling programs. A number of states, New York, Delaware, Rhode Island, localities like Chicago, New York City, Tucson, state of California, where I'm from, have passed legislation that we have supported establishing these types of recycling programs. So I think it's important when we talk about recycling, there's a little bit of a disconnect between recyclables that go into a commingled stream that may cause problems at MRFs versus recyclables that are collected through these clean take-back programs. That's where we believe the focus ought to be on. The industry is willing to sit down and discuss which ways we can enhance recycling to make sure that it works, that it's convenient, and it's successful in diverting material from disposal. So with that, we would contend that there are better solutions, not just for consumers, but for businesses as well, than SB 536 as it's drafted, and we would encourage a no vote at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Huffman.
Yes, Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Bill Huffman. I own two 7-Eleven stores in Coos Bay, and I am president of our Franchise Owners Association. I represent about 130 stores, 7-Eleven stores in Oregon. And I need to bring you a little bit of a perspective of how does this affect a small store format. There's cost, there's convenience, and there's choice. I did a study with a fellow franchisee that has a store in an area that bans plastic bags. He pays about $180 a month more for bags than I do. That may not seem like much, but it does add up. And, you know, we're small businessmen. Things are tight. The deposit that you've talked about on bags, that's putting a penalty on our customers to get a plastic bag. I just don't feel good about that, penalizing customers for using a paper bag. I'm not a professional presenter here, so
just take your time.
Okay. Our customers have had the choice between paper and plastic for many years. Their clear choice is plastic. That is what the customer wants. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration. You were talking a little bit earlier, Senator Thompson, about the bottle bill. I've been in this business since before the bottle bill started, and it's a different deal. The bottle bill and the way we do it now, that's all dependent upon a scan bar to happen. That happens at a wholesaler level, then it goes to the store. I've racked my brains trying to figure out how are we going to put a deposit on paper bags. For one thing, about 3% of the bags that we use or that we buy are unusable. For one reason or another, the double bag situation. In a small store format where our average sale is less than $5, are people going to pay 5 and 10 cents for a couple of bags? The customers that we get in the small store format don't come in with reusable bags. Maybe one in 2 weeks comes into our stores with a reusable bag. It just isn't a viable option for many of our customers. So I'd just like you guys to think about things from the perspective of the small stores, and I'm looking forward to losing $4,000 a year. To me, that's a lot of money if this goes through. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Effram. Mr. Culling?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, thank you for having me. My name is Josh Culling. I'm with Americans for Tax Reform, a national taxpayer advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., and I speak here today in opposition to Senate Bill 536. I will be very brief. You have written, prepared remarks from me, and much of what I have to say has already been said. I'd like to supplement it with just a few additional facts for the benefit of the committee. ATR's opposition to this piece of legislation is essentially threefold. We believe that it represents a regressive it's a regressive hit on the low-income community in Oregon. Its health and environmental impacts, frankly, are questionable, and most importantly, it ignores and possibly even inhibits the major political and economic issue of the day, and that's job creation and economic growth. The one thing I haven't heard much about today thus far is the regressive nature of this bill. The 5 cent per bag fee, I mean, intuitively eats up a larger portion of the income, disposable income of low-income residents. You know, we've heard from advocates for the paper bag industry and some environmental groups, but we haven't really heard an advocate for low-income Oregonians, and I think that's very important, especially at a time like this when low-income families are really diligently and making difficult decisions about their household budgets. You know, government propping up the cost of going to the grocery store I don't think is a very wise move. In terms of the health and environmental impacts, I'll just breeze through this because it's been mentioned, but you know, there have been multiple studies that have discovered large quantities of contaminants in reusable bags, and I would point out that it's a serious matter to the point that the senior senator from the state of New York, Chuck Schumer, actually asked the FDA to look into lead content. And this is, you know, Chuck Schumer is probably one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate. So it's a legitimate concern that has appeal across the aisle. Finally, and I think most importantly, it does have an impact on job creation and economic growth. And I believe this is where I can add one fact that has not been discussed yet today. We at ATR commissioned a study on a similar, somewhat similar proposal in my hometown of Washington, a recently passed 5 cent per bag tax, and found that as a direct result of that legislation, 100 jobs in the district were lost, as well as over $5.5 million in aggregate disposable income, and as a secondary effect of that, city government lost over $100,000 in sales tax revenue. So, you know, at a time when job creation is very important, even assuming that this bill has no impact, which I wouldn't concede that point, but assuming that it does, it's questionable that this is the type of legislation that the legislature would be moving now rather than streamlining government, getting it out of the way of private sector-led job creation. So with that, my full remarks are in front of you. I appreciate the opportunity to come out here and testify. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Question?
Question?
Let them start their side this time.
Okay. Senator House.
Thank you, Adam. I don't have any questions. I do have a comment, Mr. Cohen. I'm not sure if you read the bill, but there are provisions for low-income Oregonians here. And to you and Mr. Shostak, I too say welcome to our state. I do have more tokens of appreciation for you here. So thank you for keeping the dialogue open.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Culling, since you come from Washington, D.C., I presume you're familiar with our import imbalance with China?
Yes, Senator.
Would our importing these recyclable bags from China add to that import imbalance?
I believe it would, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Culling, have you heard of paper bags?
Yes, sir.
Talked about, heard about cloth bags?
Yes, sir.
Do they use cloth bags back in D.C.?
Some do. They had to pay for them, though.
Is there a problem with cloth bags?
They cost money, certainly.
But you can reuse them?
Sure.
And go ahead.
And they
also have some of the some similar, maybe not as bad as the reusable plastic, but certainly there are some health concerns there as well.
You know anybody that's gotten sick from using reusing any of those three bags in a retail setting?
Senator, I personally don't.
Did you read the bill before you got out here?
Yes, sir.
And so you didn't see the provisions regarding low-income families being able to not be charged for the fee?
Aside, sir and Madam Chair, from the fee for the paper bags, I think the ultimate intent is to get individuals to buy reusable bags to keep. And, you know, that's an expense that it makes up a larger portion of low-income families' budget.
Well, have you looked at other foreign countries as to how people that are, let's say, lower economic on the lower-income families, how they do their shopping and reuse bags in their countries?
No, sir, I have not.
Thanks.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming here. And we certainly appreciate all you out-of-state people boosting the economy of Oregon. Hopefully you're staying in a hotel tonight and having some dinner and purchasing things. Okay, next up, we have, let's keep going down the list. I have Mike Sullivan, who's with the Association of Western Paper Pulp Workers. Am I getting that right? Sorry.
Pulp and paper.
Pulp and paper. Okay. It's late. I apologize. Alana Queenie. And then also we'll have Travis Williams come up. Travis, is, I thought I saw him here. Okay. Moving right along. Thank you.
Hi. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers here in Oregon. And I thank you for allowing me to speak. AWPPW, as it's commonly known, rather than go through the long name, is in support of Senate Bill 536. In the last few years, the association has lost about 900 jobs in Oregon, jobs in plants like Blue Herring, which I believe is in Senator Olson's district. And speaking of Blue Herring, it's probably a little dated, but a benchmark to read is an article called Beaten to the Pulp, which was in a Willamette Week, and it features Blue Herring. Excuse me, and it talks about the trade imbalance. Then, when the article was written, raw stock for paper was being shipped to China 6,000 miles away, cheaper than we can get it here in Oregon. The plant had to import stock from the Midwest in order to operate. And then with the environmental laws and co-mingling, they are now, and trade, are now in bankruptcy. The Blue Herring plant also produces half the stock right now for all the McDonald's bags in the United States. And the other paper and pulp plants here in Oregon could easily transfer over to paper bags if needed so. The increase in the demand, of course, would create more work for our workers that are displaced. And on the environmental issue, there is Local 3 in Toledo with Georgia-Pacific that has an annual cleanup of the river. So an issue of the environment is also an issue for the employers and the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. This is a step in the right direction, we think. If for anything, it's fiscally responsible to take care of the citizens of the state first and create jobs here. And, you know, I'm kind of smiling when I say this, but buy Oregon first. Thank you, and I will answer any questions that you might ask,
great,
if I can.
We'll hear from the rest of the folks up there, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, my name is Travis Williams, and I'm Executive Director and Riverkeeper for Willamette Riverkeeper. We spend a lot of time throughout the Willamette Basin around the mainstem Willamette and its many tributaries, and I see this as a pretty simple issue, and we've supported the previous incarnation of this bill and support SB 536 this time around. These plastic bags are literally everywhere. You see them in our rivers, you see them in our roads, you see them up in the trees sometimes. I could go to the Willamette mainstem, I could go to the Santiam, I could go to the Coast Fork, I could go to the Grand Ronde River, which I have. Even Senator Ferrioli's great river in his district, in response to Mrs. Kern's comments, the John Day Wild and Scenic Stretch. Guess what? You will find plastic bags along that river. Eventually, some of that plastic breaks down, fragments, and makes it to the Columbia and subsequently gets its way into the Pacific Ocean, contributing to a problem that is very real. And for those who seek to diminish the problem by citing the recent work by OSU and NOAA trying to assess the patch size, who cares if it's 10,000 square miles or 3,000 square miles in a particular area? It's a huge problem, and I think we all know that it ends up everywhere. So to me, this is really easy. It's not about paper versus plastic. Let's start reusing bags that use again and again and again. They can be made of that material, or they can be cotton. You want to talk about a T-shirt bag? Hey, let's see more cotton bags out there. Me and my partner in our home with our kids, we probably over the years have purchased maybe 10 or 12 of these bags. We wash them sometimes. Certainly we're sensible enough that if there's some emergency with a chicken package leaking, guess what? We're going to go throw that in the washer and dry it and use it next time. I think Oregon can demonstrate real leadership with this bill. It's the right thing to do. It's sensible, and it's the right approach to take now. And I think, on the whole, when people get to the checkout line and they're presented with an opportunity to buy a product that is reusable and really think about it for a minute, that they will begin to opt for bags such as that or cotton bags. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you, Travis. Would you go ahead, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, representing 225,000 middle-class and working Oregonians. A lot of people have said this before. I won't take up too much of your time, and you have our written testimony, but this is a session about jobs, and this bill gives us the opportunity to support jobs in Oregon while also doing something that is better for our state and that continues our pattern of being a leader on issues like this. We think this is a good bill. It's good for people in the state of Oregon, and it's good for jobs in Oregon. We hope that you support it.
Thank you. You get the quickest testimony award. Okay, we'll start on this side, see if there's any questions. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Ma'am, how many jobs will be created?
You know, I can't speak to that because I don't know how many workers will be added depending on the increase in use of paper bags. I don't know how much that increase will be, but I think if you talk to our grocery store owners about what they've seen in paper bag increases and our representatives from the pulp and paper workers, we might be able to figure that out.
Follow-up.
Hold on. I just want to say, you want to speak to that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, it's a loaded question because it really is on the demand of the paper, you know.
Okay. Yeah, I understand
it. It's hard to say.
Follow up. Will any of our bags be imported from outside of the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we represent the workers, not management. I couldn't answer that question.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Next up, Terry Parker, my constituent, Todd Wynn, and Ann Taylor. Okay, so, Terry, you want to go first?
Fine. Okay, Terry Parker. Is it on? Terry Parker, Northeast Portland. You've heard about the wolf in sheep's clothing. With this legislation, when the plastic bag wrapper is removed, a cloud of shady socialism is exposed. Likewise, the only emergency here is the rush to move forward with a dictator-like mythology that includes social engineering agenda, which further chips away at the freedoms this country was found on. This caters to the special interests, just like the bicyclists, increasing the cost of living for the mainstream population and eliminating even more self-sustaining private sector American jobs, which then creates a demand for more taxpayer-funded subsidized jobs. It's easy to see why Oregon is so deeply entrenched in a recession. Presumably, most of you do business at those overpriced, trendy little boutique foodstuff stores in your neighborhood. You don't see the common folk with families at places like Winco pushing an overflow full cart of groceries, sometimes two full carts of groceries, out to their car, having either to bring multiple carryout bags or pay for courtesy bags every time a person goes into a retail store just doesn't work. Cloth bags are inconvenient and not always sanitary. How much additional cost and costly water will it take attempting to keep those cloth bags clean and free of germs? Moreover, how much will security have to be increased if more people are walking around in stores with cloth bags that they can hide things in? The entire premise of this legislation is based on a lie. Calling the plastic checkout bags a single-use product is a narrow-minded, erroneous ploy. Nothing more than hyped-up propaganda and misinformation for the media that some of the greedy retail giants now support. For example, these so-called single-use bags from grocery stores and elsewhere are routinely used by small and resale businesses to save on overhead costs. A cigarette is a single-use product, and there are far more butts cluttering the streets than plastic bags. If you really want to reduce single-use bags that go directly into the landfill, then do so within the confines of government by banning the use of plastic wastebasket and garbage can liners at all state and local government-owned facilities and banning ODOT from using those big plastic bags that are used to pick up litter. Finally, if you are so self-confident the populace of Oregon will support an outright ban on plastic checkout bags and charging for paper ones, then at the very least, back that up with a requirement or an amendment that any kind of plastic bag ban and or minimum carryout fee will be referred to the people for their up or down vote. Not doing so basically indicates editorial deception is in the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry, for your testimony. Ms. Taylor?
Hi, thank you.
We just need you to make sure and state your name for the record and
speak into
the mic.
Yeah, it's Ann Taylor. I'm making a fashion statement here.
You need to move
as you can see, it's white. I have to walk. I don't drive. I'm on a fixed income, and this is a very good reflective thing to have at night. Probably less than 5% you will see in the recycle receptor, and they usually have rips and tears. I'm the cat lady. I take care of feral cats. I'd like to see that litter problem. We're basically addressing a litter problem in the state as I see it. Having pets, we'll be looking for another kind of waste. People use these, for dogs and cats and garbage. I use it to put garbage in place of the big bags, which I don't need, which I'll have to buy. And I have a feeling if these are banned, we're going to find the big plastic and the little plastic that you have to put meat in and stuff in the streams anyway. We're going to have to get it cleaned up. And how you do it is you like the people with the fish and wildlife, they're the ones that use the woods. Okay, they pay maybe a small fee. I hate to do that. For the cleanup, you hire someone. Get that company from Texas here now to recycle these. We need the jobs. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time and the concern, but I use these all the time, and I would have no way to get my food home except in the cloth bags. And I walk in the rain, and, we have rain here.
Yeah, you might have to tell the folks from Texas that we have rain here.
Yeah, I think that's your job, but yes. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Why don't you hold on? There might be some questions. And I know we have your testimony, but I know you'll keep it to 2 minutes.
Definitely.
Right? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am Vice President of Cascade Policy Institute, Oregon's free market public policy research organization. And I came here to testify against Senate Bill 536. Cascade Policy Institute, in cooperation with Beacon Hill Institute and Americans for Tax Reform, just released a report analyzing the economic impact of the bag ban, and more specifically, the fee on paper bags. Now, in my testimony, you'll see that I use the word tax, but you can just exchange that for the word fee or charge. Now, I'm not going to go into the depth of the study as I've provided copies for the committee. Well, I will go over the highlights. For fiscal year 2012, in 1 year, the fee on paper bags would likely raise between $6.2 to $14.5 million, depending upon the economic model used. So this means Oregonians would have less income to spend on other goods and services, resulting in a decline of sales and profits for retail stores across the state, leading to a reduction of employment of approximately 277 jobs and causing annual wages to fall by $27 per worker. Now, aggregate real disposable income would fall by $2.3 million due to the increased cost felt at retail stores across the state, and it would lower investment by $2.1 million, with the bulk of the loss occurring in the retail industry. Really, to sum it up, a ban on single-use bags is a fee, and with a fee on the alternative, is a negative impact on employment and income in the state overall. The bill specifically states that this is declaring an emergency for the immediate preservation of the public health, safety, and peace. But there's a lot of Oregonians that are struggling to make ends meet in this state, and this is going to add to their grocery bills when they buy the food that they need. So I'm pretty sure that this is not the right time for this bill, but I'm not exactly sure that there's ever a right time for this bill. Fundamentally, banning a choice for consumers and forcing retail stores to charge a government-imposed price is not the proper role of government. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions for the panel? Okay, Todd, I have a question for you in the sheet that you handed out here, and we can probably talk about this offline as well, but you have in here you state about job total employment, jobs lost. Does that include, as I'd asked before, about job increases with the paper bag industry? So did your analysis look at just plastic bags, or did you look at paper bags as well?
Madam Chair, this, I believe, I'll get back to you on this, I believe that this is a dynamic model, so it does assess job increases and job losses, so net job loss of 277.
Okay. Now, if you could send that, that would be helpful, yeah.
Todd, it sounds like you didn't do this study yourself. Who did do the study?
We worked in, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, we worked with Beacon Hill Institute, economists at Beacon Hill Institute in Massachusetts, and also with Americans for Tax Reform to put out this study just a couple days ago.
Okay. Well, it would be helpful to see that along with the assumptions that were used as part of this study, as I'd asked the other folks to send as well.
Madam Chair, definitely. And at the bottom of the testimony, you'll see some of the description of the state tax analysis mapping program used and the methodology there. But I'll send you all the information via email.
Great. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Thank you all for coming here today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Next up, Kathy Beckwith from Yamhill County. Saba? Saba here? She was here. So we'll call her up in a minute. Then Brian Wagner and Mike McConnell. Okay. Sounds like there's a party outside, I think. Apologize for the noise.
Thank you
for waiting.
And thank you for allowing public input and seeking it. So I come from a consumer dynamic.
And can you state your name, please?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Kathy Beckwith. And I come from a consumer dynamic on this issue. I know there are some things that we as public consumers have to take responsibility for. And I am one that kind of grinned when I read the editorial in our local paper that said maybe the best thing the legislature could do would be to legislate how we could remember to take our bags back to the store, because that was a problem for me. But I set a penalty for myself that if I didn't do that, I would just put the groceries in the cart and take them out to the trunk. And when I got home, I would, you know, I would then care.
Can you hold on just a minute? Folks, we're going to have to ask you, please, if you leave, you got to close the door because we're having a hard time hearing. Thank you.
Well, please keep it down. We're trying to do a hearing impairment.
We sent out the bulldog to take care of it. Okay.
So
I apologize.
Okay. I know I, too, am part of the problem because I have twice recently forgotten to take my bags. And, in fact, before I came to this meeting today, I just put them in the car. And I thought, well, you know, that should have been an easy fix. So we as consumers will have to change some, but I think we can do that. And we could have bag-making parties if we chose that all over the state of Oregon. But one thing we can't do is fix a problem that our economy has had long term, and that is considering the true cost of a product, which includes its impact on the earth, impact on, you know, animals in the earth, its centuries of time to be broken down. And we haven't done that with plastic, so that even if we're talking about a little bit of success with recycling, a lot of this, okay, sorry. A lot of the plastic isn't taken care of. It just hasn't been solved. And that is something that the legislature can help with. I like to think of our situation at home. My husband had one mule, and over the years, he's now up to 6 mules. And every morning when he goes out, because it's winter now and the mules are in the barn and in the little corral there, there's a big pile of manure there. And hauling that to the manure pile is a part of the responsibility of having 6 mules. The fact is, we haven't done that with plastic use. And so the cost and the responsibility has not been reflected. And I, as a consumer, can't do what the Oregon State Legislature can in saying, you know what, we never resolved this problem, so we're not going to have it until we can figure out something better. And I think you have an opportunity to now say this is a huge problem for our environment, for the world, for the people of Oregon, and, you know, for the oceans, for our waterways, and we will do something about it. I taught in India about 10 years ago, and 2 boys came to me and said in their class they wanted their service project to be to get the town of Kodaikanal to ban plastic bags. I was not a believer. I said, you have to start with our school stockroom. If they won't do it, what hope would there be? And so I was not an encourager because I thought people wouldn't change. People would resent this. But there, the garbage shows up behind the buildings, behind the schools, along the lake. Their garbage service wasn't as good as ours. Well, what we do is put our garbage away. We throw things away. But I saw a film recently that said, where is a way? You know, with plastic, a way doesn't happen. So it's centuries later that that's finally taken care of. Luckily, those boys kept on, and when I went back to that school in India, the town had adopted this, and there are no plastic bags used in the retail outlets there. They have cloth bags. I brought some of those back with me. So I think we can learn from kids, and we can learn from our neighbors in another country, and we can do the right thing, which I believe is for the legislature to say we have to deal with one thing that we can do, not all of plastics right now, but with the plastic thing, plastic bag question, which is huge for us, and just say we will stop the use and we'll invite Oregonians to be a part of the mental revolution that we can feel to be a part of something really good and positive. And I will have a bag party if that, I mean, that just came to me sitting over there, but I think we could do it, and it could be a great thing for the rest of the country to watch what you do here at the Oregon Legislature.
Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Mark McConnell. I'm mayor of the city of Newport.
Oh, welcome,
and
Mayor.
Thank you.
Sorry you had to wait so long.
That's all right. I could have put down 100 miles, but it isn't quite that far.
I was going to say that, yes, you
It seems like 100 when you drive that far. And also, I would like to let you know that I'm a healthy reuser of grocery bags. I have been doing that for about 25 years. I have not had a single sickness from that process. On the 6th of December in 2010, the City of Newport City Council unanimously passed Resolution Number 3529 as a resolution supporting the Oregon State Legislature in passing legislation which bans single-use plastic checkout bags. We forwarded a copy of this to Senator Haas and Senator Atkinson. I don't know if you've received that through the packet or not. If not, we'll make sure we get a copy to you. I think the most important whereas inside of this is that the council acknowledges the city's economy is dependent on clean and healthy ocean resources, and that includes the beaches and the rivers that move into the ocean, and that is for our commercial fishing fleet and for the tourism and recreation aspects of the use of the beaches. I think that pretty much sums it up.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here today. Brian.
Hi, I'm Brian Wagoner. I'm the Watershed Watch Coordinator and Riverkeeper for Tualatin Riverkeepers. One of the reasons Tualatin Riverkeepers got involved with this problem is because of the grassroots pressure to do so. Typically in my job, I'm trying to educate people about regulations, TMDLs and NPDES permits and different types of pollutants that are very complex for the average person to understand. But I kept getting calls that saying, Brian, you got to do something about these plastic bags. It's a problem we see that we can do something about. Just to get an idea of what the problem was, I took a walk down the street from our office to Fano Creek on my lunch hour a few days ago, and I took my camera and I just started stamping pictures of every plastic bag I saw in the creek. And I saw 68 bags in a half a mile stretch. And so I sent out the word to people across the street. I said, send me your pictures of plastic bags. And we have that presentation here. We're not going to show it. Did you, we'll blow the 2 minutes, but I'll put it on the web tonight. And
yeah.
I know Channel.
Why didn't you send us a link?
Last night, okay. Channel 8 is going to show some of these pictures tonight. But we got pictures from Port Orford to Hermiston. People had sent us the plastic bags, our beautiful state, and these ugly bags out there. And I was very appreciative of Senator Atkinson's history lesson comparing to this. To the self-service gasoline and the bottle bill that happened 40 years ago because of the grassroots effort. And I just, we did a little online petition. We have 484 Oregonians and 37 people from outside of Oregon, none of them from Texas, that signed our petition that said, we urge you to ban plastic bags and to put a charge on paper bags to encourage people to use their own reusable shopping bags. Mr. Wynn said that the fees from the paper bags would raise $6.2 to $14.5 million. I think that's a great job creator because we're replacing bags that are made outside of Oregon with resources that aren't grown in Oregon, with a product that is made in Oregon, and with resources grown in Oregon and resources recycled in Oregon. And I think this has great economic benefits besides the environmental benefits. And one last thing, we talk about having market solutions to environmental problems. Well, if we're letting people off the hook by giving them away plastic bags and they're not paying for those bags or the environmental impacts of them, then that's a subsidy that the environment is paying for their convenience. If we put a nickel charge on paper bags, that's the least giving them the cost of the bag and that price signal to alter their behavior, to behave responsibly in a way that will protect our environment.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel before we let them go?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Mayor, did you ban all plastic bags in Newport?
We didn't ban. We passed a resolution to support the legislation before you.
Okay.
And we will go back and make an attempt to do that if the state doesn't provide a statewide bill.
Follow-up.
Why was your city council or your folks motivated to do this?
For many of the reasons that everyone has stated here, the biggest reason is to get the plastic bags off the beaches and out of the rivers and off the side of the road.
Follow-up. One last, and I'll let you go. I've been to Newport. It's a beautiful city. I love it. The restaurants will not be exempt from this. Do you think you will still find restaurant bags on the ocean?
If we don't get, you know, there likely will be some out there.
Okay.
But, you know, less is better than as many as we have now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming here today. Jamie Jackson, Doug Hoffman, and Fred Yates. We are getting towards the end of the list, committee members.
Yep.
We have a few more folks that would like to come up and testify. Okay, welcome. Why don't you go ahead and get started and state your name for the record, please?
Yeah, my name is Jamie Jackson. I've actually heard most of the points that I was thinking about making already made, so I'll just keep it really simple and say, as a consumer, somebody that goes and shops, I like the choice that I have of choosing which kind of bag I use, and I do reuse my plastic bags. I just think that this is the wrong approach to try and bring the band hammer down and just make everybody march to the same drum. I heard the word confusion put out there, and I would think the flip side of that is you could also call it freedom of choice. And there is confusion, but if I can go to a different store and shop in a different way or whatever, I can make that choice. I'm capable of doing that. So that's basically
my
thoughts.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, I'm Doug Hoffman. I'm president and CEO of Wilco Farmers. We run a small business, a couple hundred million dollars up and down I-5. We have locations in Eugene, clear up to Tacoma. We have 26 locations spread throughout the valley. We run lifestyle farm stores. Country Lifestyle, where we do sell lawn and garden. We sell products there. We sell plants, and we move a lot of bags. And in particular, I provided you a bag, not necessarily to put our logo on it, but I figured you would need something to haul all your stuff home tonight. Okay, so it's one of the things there. And we are in the process. We have a half a million customers, and we use about 500,000 bags a year. And those bags, you know, it's quoted today that they cost a nickel for a paper bag. Our cost is looking at 13.6 cents for a paper bag. Same kind of bag grocery stores have. So, depending on, we're a small business. We're not, we don't have the mega size of Safeway in order to buy. Our plastic bags are costing us about 5 cents today. The bag that's being passed out to you there right now is $1.19. We have some customers who like to use those reusable bags. We're providing some free, even, because we encourage that. In particular, I'm a little bit concerned about food safety. If they took those same bags that were used to haul plants out or garden chemicals in particular, and they went to the grocery store, a little bit concerned on food safety there. So as far as, you know, the grocery industry says that everybody was brought to the table to discuss this, I would question if any hardware stores, small businesses were involved in that discussion. I sure was not invited to the table, that is for sure, as we look at that particular business. The last thing, a question on in the bill itself, is the way I read the bill, local communities could still ban the bags. You're going to put a price tag on it, but I believe that they could still ban it. They just can't charge a tax. Might be my misreading there. And the last point I want to make, and then I'll move on here, is really as we would look to move to these particular kind of bags as a sole source for usable bags, that's about a $600,000 investment for Wilco to make. And it costs us about $100,000 a year to continue to replace these bags as we would go through there. That's an insurmountable cost for, in particular, for our business. If we were looking to just go to paper bags away from the polys at our cost at 13.6, that's another $45,000 a year in costs for us. So from a raw economic side of it, as we look at our business, we'd say that's one job if we have to go to paper versus poly. So we're about jobs. We're about creating jobs. We want to have jobs. I think this bill is bad. I'm opposed to the bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the council, my name is Fred Yates. I represent Americans for Prosperity from Linn County and 912 Salem Project. I am opposed to Senate Bill 536. It seems to me it's an attempt to legislate behavior, and we've heard many people speak to the fact we have litter. Litter is caused by people, not by the paper bags. I want to just talk about the perils of unintended consequences. We all agreed a long time ago that reducing our dependence on foreign oil was wonderful. And so we launched the country an ethanol-based fuel program. But it had many unintended consequences, and here's just a couple. Bioenergy has already eclipsed food, livestock feed, and other uses as a major driver of American agriculture. We all have seen our prices go up in our food, and that's because of all the corn fructose syrup in there. About 70% more energy is required to produce ethanol than the energy that's actually in ethanol. So every time you make a gallon of ethanol, there's a net energy loss of 54,000 BTUs. We're on the backside, even though we thought this was a wonderful thing. Okay, cash for clunkers. Okay, that's another program that had a wonderful sound for it, but the program, which cost taxpayers over $3 billion, resulted in the taxpayers paying an average of $24,000 per vehicle. It turns out that of the 690,000 vehicles sold, only about 125,000 of those sales were entirely due to the government's added incentive. So there was a bunch of lucky people out there, in fact, 565,000 of them. Finally, I'd like to address just a few unintended consequences associated with paper bag usage. Number one, with paper bag usage, yes. Plastic bags were brought into existence back in the 1970s to save the environment. Now we're having them destroyed to save the environment. Banning plastic bags in Los Angeles County, there was a study done, okay, would have the same annual impact on greenhouse gas emissions of adding between 27,000 and 63,000 passenger vehicles. L.A. County has about 12 million people. We have about 4 million people. So therefore, it means it's like adding 11,000 cars or 25,000 cars here in Oregon. The German cockroach loves grocery bags. The roach will infest a stack of paper bags in the grocery store, then sneak home in between the flaps and the bottom of the bag. Now you got the roach infestation in your home.
Sir, if you could wrap up, we do have your written testimony.
Okay. I think the biggest single important one is the 2007 Bosted report points out that it takes 3.4 times as much energy to produce a paper bag. It creates almost five times the municipal solid waste. It creates twice as much CO2 pollution, and it uses 17 times as much water to produce. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for this panel?
I have one.
Thanks, Senator Olson.
Mr. Huffman, you work for Wilco. You own Wilco. You're the president of Wilco?
I am the president of Wilco. I work for 3,000 farmers.
Okay. If a farmer comes in and he buys, and I know you sell hardware because I have a store in my town. If a farmer comes in and buys hardware, typically do you put it in a plastic bag for him?
Yes.
If he was to buy 10 pounds of half-inch anchor bolts, would they handle it? Would a paper bag handle that weight?
First of all, we'd probably have to double bag it, and most of the time it would land on the floor.
Okay.
It'd fall apart. Can't handle the weight.
Any other questions?
Yes, follow-up. Mm-hmm. What basically then is a paper bag wouldn't be adequate for your store system?
No, it would not.
Thank you.
It would not.
Follow-up.
My understanding that the bill would not prohibit you from using the plastic bags inside the store for products inside. It's when you get to the takeout and you're checking out. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, but as the person would bring a piece of hardware up, a piece of angle iron, for example, and how are we going to take that out? Either going to carry it out in his hand, you know, a bag of bolts, yes, you might put a bag of bolts and put it inside, but if you got 10 pounds of bolts, it might be on a plastic bag. It's still got to get carried out the door. What's the definition of a checkout then? If I have 10 pounds of bolts that I pick up in the back of the store, it's in a plastic bag, and I'm going to carry that out. Is that what the way I would read the bill? That would be a checkout. You need to charge a nickel for that bag.
My understanding, that's not the case.
Well, we'll get clarification. No. And just to clarify, you sell these bags that you handed out at your store?
We sell them, and we also give them away in promotions.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, next up, Saba. Sorry we called you and you were out of the room. Ralph Groner. Ralph, you want to come up? Tiara. Who's that? Okay, Saba, so you've got 2 minutes, so
sure.
Is this going to be a two-minute PowerPoint?
It's just pictures. It's
okay.
Not really
okay.
Anything I can talk to.
Okay, well, why don't you get started, and hopefully
sure.
So you can get the pictures up, and just a reminder to state your name for the record.
Sure. Madam Chair, my name is Saba Ahmed, and I'm a resident of Beaverton, Oregon, and I'm testifying in support of this bill. I represent over 35,000 Muslim Americans, Muslim Oregonians, and from our Green Initiative, this is a bill that we are supporting, and I'm here to testify in support of it. What I did want to mention this morning, I stopped by Woodburn outlet stores for shopping before coming here, and I did a brief survey of the stores there to find out which stores sell plastic, give plastics or paper. And what I found out was a lot of stores actually already carry paper bags. And it was also eye-opening to find out some stores that didn't. And I wanted to share that because I think this is very Oregon-like. And just to say an example, both paper bags and plastic bags are offered at Polo, Ralph Lauren, Banana Republic, and Calvin Klein. But stores such as Adidas and Levi's only offer paper bags, which is like really good for our Oregon. Stuff. And what I wanted to just quickly point out in my PowerPoint.
Well, I'll tell you what, Saba, while you're getting it up, why don't we have Ralph go and then we'll come back to it, okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record's Ralph Groner.
Today I'm representing three chapters. One is Local 3336, which is my DEQ membership, Local 3580, which is my Metro membership, and my Ask Me Green Caucus. Mine won't take long. I, for one, have used nothing but paper. My wife and I were known as shopaholics on the weekend because at our age, the most fun thing we have is to go shopping. And so every Sunday for many years, I have taken my wife and I go shopping. And we go to Fred Meyer's. Sometimes we're in Camby Freddy's. Sometimes we're in our Freddy's in Oregon City. And I get double bags because I like them heavy. I don't like them light. And then I take those home, and they go with all my paper in Oregon City. We have recycle bag, and we have garbage cans. My recycle goes to my local grade school, which appreciates the paper. All my paper I take to the grade school in their big box so that they can buy supplies with it. The only thing I have to say is I'm just sick and tired personally of the plastic bags in Oregon littering this beautiful state that I was born and raised in. And I really feel that that should be a shameful, shameful thing, and it needs to be done away with. I also shop every week at Costco to brag on them. They do not use plastic bags. I hate to tell Wilco that. Costco uses, as some of you must know, since I'm a weekly migrant to that store, they use boxes. And I tear that box up when I get home, usually five or six large ones. That's how we shop. We're not the small shoppers. I have grandchildren, children, everybody's moved into my house. And the fact is, I rip them up and take that up to my school also. In the end, as to the cleanliness of the bags, all I can say is why Sharon and I bought big Costco bags long ago. We do our shopping wherever we go rather than at Costco. At least we used our bags. One thought occurred to me. I would ask Freddy's to say, you already send me, after a couple months, I get $33, $40 back free because I shop there. One of the things they could do is offer coupons in their coupon book that they send to all of us for these returnable these bags that can be reused. And I think Fred Meyer would do that. And I know Safeway's coming to Oregon City, gigantic. They just told me their largest Safeway store in the whole region. So, in the end, probably why we don't get ill using our reusable bags is because when we're going shopping, coming out the door, my wife always says, get the lead out, let's hurry up. Thank you.
Sava, do you can Thank you go you. Very quickly?
Sure,
we
quickly.
We still have more people that would like to testify.
Great. Well, I'll just take a minute. Just basically, I wanted to summarize that plastic bags are not non-biodegradable. That's mainly why we're supporting it, and we really want to protect Oregon's environment and the scenic beauty. We also want to join other leading nations such as India, China, in their global green initiative. I think this we would be joining a world green initiative. I originally come from Pakistan, and I know plastic bags are even banned over there, so it's kind of interesting to see that the United States doesn't have that. Just like I said, I did some, this was just me being this morning coming here, just doing a survey of the local stores. They do have paper only, plastic only stores, and I think this would be an encouragement to create new initiatives. Companies such as Adidas, Levi's, Guess, Coach, Ann Taylor, and Christine Alexander, they all also only offer paper bags in Oregon stores. And some of the companies such as Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Eddie Bauer, Van Heusen, Rockport, White House, and Black Market, they only do plastic bags. It might be a good thought once the bill is passed for them to look into supporting other stores. And obviously, Ralph Lauren, Banana Republic, and Calvin Klein offered both. I think this bill will provide an opportunity for all retailers, not just grocery stores, to look into paper options. So thank you.
Thank you. It's not always that we get a smiley face in the committee, so
sorry.
Thank you for that. Go ahead. You can tell it's really getting late.
Chair's tired. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you as a citizen. My name is Tiara Foster. I'm a student over at Willamette University. This is my first time
welcome.
Testifying. Thank you very
come
much.
Come over more often.
I'll try to. This has been a really eye-opening experience, and I just want to say I'm disappointed that there's not more people my age here expressing
their passion for keeping Oregon green, keeping Oregon beautiful. At Willamette, sustainability is a very big part of the way we conduct business, just through education and also choices that Bon Appetit and student-led things, our associations with Xena Farm, we try to be as sustainable as possible in our personal choices and with keeping the school accountable with their choices of where we're spending money and consumer choices. I'm a product of Oregon. I was born on Center Street, and I can't say that sustainability is anything new to me. I'm very proud to say that I have been brought up with sustainability and with things like litter and my personal choices impacting the environment. So I'd like to see this bill be passed. I would also like to say, even if it is not passed, I will work to educate, be a voice, and teach my children to be sustainable, think about their personal consumer choices, and I think truly this bill would be an opportunity for Oregonians to show the rest of the nation and other countries not doing this what an impact it can be to remove plastic bags from our consumer choices.
Okay. Thank you for being here today. Any questions for any of the panelists? Senator Olson, be kind to the students.
I will.
Senator Olson.
And thank you very much for coming across the street to testify. I really appreciate that. You mentioned personal choices. If the state of Oregon, this legislative body, bans plastic bags,
correct,
doesn't that affect your personal choices?
I don't see it as infringing on a personal choice. I see it as we still have the choice if we are silly and we forget our reusable cloth bags that we have either acquired either through purchase or through promotion, then I have no problem paying the 5 cents. I am your typical poor college student. I live under the poverty level. So for me to be able to commit that, I think it's a big deal, but that's how much the environment means to me. And I would much rather have a healthy environment, and I feel much more secure about having children and continuing just sustainable practices. I don't really see it as infringing on my personal choices, because I think we still have the option of purchasing a bag, and 5 cents is not that much to ask.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here today. We've got a few more folks that have decided to stick it out with us. Thank you for waiting and your patience. We have Judith McKinney, Wayne Brady, and Mary Sue Gilliland. Oh, and we have Jeff Krupp. Is Jeff here?
Yes, in the back.
Okay. Jeff, you'll get the last word. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, all right.
Bad.
We have to find out if anyone else wants to.
Oh, yeah, no. We've got a few more. Okay. Welcome, and if you want to get started, why don't you go ahead and please state your name for the record.
I'm Judith McKinney. I'm a resident of Silverton. It's nice to be here today. I've never done this before, so please bear with me.
Well, thank you for waiting. We don't usually go this long. It's a very interesting topic.
I'm sort of passionate about this, and I was really against the ban when I first heard about it. And then I read some information about it on the Internet and some information about the environmental impact of the litter. And then I kind of went, well, I'm not so sure that I'm really against it. But I've listened to everybody today. And one thing that I'm more passionate about than what I've heard today is the loss of freedom and individual choice. And this is happening all over. I wrote this thing. I don't want to read it for you, but the tendency to fix all of our problems in the society with a law is a very dangerous way to go. If we continue to clutter our statutes and our constitution with trivial, petty problem solving, bit by bit we'll legislate ourselves into a very rigid and confining society in the name of whatever the current sociological fad is. And right now it's environmentalism, which I think is sort of going over the top anyway. Each little bit of restrictive legislation may seem unimportant on its own, but as they accumulate, our freedom dwindles. Along with so many seemingly innocuous laws we pass for the public good, This is just another infringement on our individual liberties as citizens in a free society. A free society cannot be perfect, as man is imperfect, but it will outperform any other kind yet conceived of. Can't we deal with some tossed-out plastic bags without tossing out our liberty? Amongst all the people I've heard testify today, I think I have been convinced not to take the plastic bags home and throw them away. I look at them. I have the cat. I have the litter. So I hold them all up to the light. The ones who don't have holes go in this pile. I use them for my cat litter. The ones who have holes go in the trash. I won't do that anymore. I'm going to take them back to the grocery store. I didn't realize that they had these recycle bins. And I think that's the way to go, but I think it's we need to know about it. I didn't know about it. Now, my behavior is going to be different after today. And I think a lot of people would feel the way I do if they knew the facts. So this hearing has been wonderfully educational for me, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and for being able to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for your observations.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Sir?
Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Wayne Brady. I'm a volunteer with the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. I've submitted two documents. First is an information sheet from the Taxpayers Association. And the second is an article about the Great Garbage Patch from the London Telegraph. The Telegraph article was put in there because there's often misinformation put out by different advocacy groups. From listening to the testimony here today, I think that probably there really is a problem here in Oregon with plastic bags. But I do think that this may not be the right approach. As Judith mentioned, I think it made a good point. Some public education could make a world of difference. And if people knew that they could take these to a recycle place, that would be a big help. I was unaware of that, too. And we also use a lot of the plastic bags for cat litter and that sort of thing. So if we don't get these, we'll end up probably going out and buying some sort of plastic bags. The other concern I have is why these particular bags. There are plastic bags on telephone books, on newspapers, and bags of for bread and a lot of other things, and those are not covered in this. So are those ending up on the beaches as well? So that's something that you might want to think about. I think we need to be careful before we rush into things like this. So at this point, I'm still in opposition to the bill.
Thank you
for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for waiting. We apologize about the long wait. Let's see if there's any questions for either of these witnesses. No. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara Wilson, Bonnie Sullivan, and Bob Salinger. Hey, Bob, you're up first, so go for it.
Excuse me. I guess I'm the only one that's left. Good evening, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm here on, my name is Bob Salinger. I'm here on behalf of the Audubon Society of Portland and our 11,000 members. And I would echo Brian Wagner's comments. We hear from our members a lot on this issue. This one really has caught their interest, and they want to know what we're doing about it and whether we're supporting it, and we are. And we really congratulate Senator Hass on his leadership on this bill. Folks have already talked about the reasons to ban the bag, and I won't reiterate those. I'll focus in on wildlife specifically, which is our area of expertise. There's a growing understanding of just how detrimental plastic is on wildlife populations and what a dramatic impact it is having. And we tend to focus on the Pacific gyre and the sea animals, but it's also having an impact on our birds in this state as well. And birds are showing up at coastal rehab centers in greater frequency that are starving. And when they die, they open them up, and what they find out is that they're literally packed with plastic. Their entire digestive tract is just one big lump of plastic that they've accumulated. They eat it when they're eating plankton, gets in their systems, it clogs them, and they starve and they die. And for anybody that doesn't think it's a problem, I would encourage you to visit one of the coastal rehab centers and look at one of these birds and tell me it's not a problem. It's also affecting land birds as well. California Audubon Society did a study of California condors, and the things they noted in terms of condor recovery, a species we're hoping to bring back to this state someday that's now being raised at the Oregon Zoo, lead is the biggest problem, but also micro garbage, of which 30% of what they're finding in those condors is plastic. So it is a real problem. We do a project with Channel 8 KGW called Raptor Cam, where we have a camera on a downtown Portland redtail nest. They nest on a fire escape. And I think one of the things that shocked people, in fact, if you go to the website and look at the blog, it's still up there, you'll see that one of the biggest topics of conversation is all the plastic that's in that nest. I've been in that nest after nesting season. I could fill a big plastic garbage bag with all the garbage they've incorporated into it, much of which is plastic. And, in fact, there was a plastic bag in that nest last year for the entire season that kept getting moved around. It was on top of the eggs. It was under the eggs. It was all over the place. And I went in at the end of the season, and it was amazing because that bag was still basically intact. This stuff never breaks down. But people were amazed, and that's what our landscape looks like. Animals pick this up, they ingest it, they wrap it into their nests. In our sanctuary on Cornell Road, plastic is a problem. When you drive up and down Cornell Road in Forest Park, the sides of the streets are littered with plastic. From our perspective, this is a common sense step forward. Does it solve every plastic problem? Absolutely not. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take a common sense step. Send a strong message. Try to wean ourselves off of plastic. People talk about education. This is an educational opportunity. It's an opportunity to take some plastic out of our system and send a very strong message to the community that we need to reduce our use of plastic. We need to stop littering. We need to focus on things that are recyclable and ideally get off the disposable bags altogether. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. If you pull the mic a little closer, there you go.
Madam Chair and committee members, I wasn't really planning on doing testimony.
Can you state your name, please?
My name is Bonnie Sullivan, and I am a member of the Marion County Solid Waste Advisory Council, and I chair the Subcommittee on Government Affairs. And so I basically came here today to try and get some information regarding this, and I commend Senator Hess and Atkinson for even bringing this issue to light. It is a tremendous problem. I have been on patrol at the beaches and collected garbage and everything, and I'm just appalled to see what is happening to the state of Oregon, and especially our beautiful beaches that, you know, I just treasure so much. And so this will be an education piece that I will share with the council members, and if we can help with any part of the education, we'll be available for that. So thank you.
Thank you for coming here today and sharing your thoughts. Any questions for the these?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Ms. Sullivan,
yes.
You're familiar with the Woodburn dump?
Oh, yes. But you mean the burner?
No, not the burner.
Oh, the transfer station?
Yeah, the garbage dump.
Yes.
I really refer to it as my garbage dump because I go there a lot. Is there a problem with plastic bags at that facility?
I have seen them there, and I have also seen them in amongst the ash of the from the burner also. So it is a problem, and definitely I've seen them there.
The reason I ask is I go there quite often. I'm a general contractor. And it's really a clean, super clean facility.
It is.
And the way they handle the waste is it's really impressive. Could we possibly establish at a facility like that a recycle facility for plastic bags?
I believe so. We have at the Salem Kaiser Transfer Station a recycle for plastic bags, and it works great. And so I think that there could be one out there. And, yes, we do have things in common, I found out today. I am a construction contractor, too, so I will probably be visiting you during the session.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Ask
for it, right?
Yeah. Ms. Sullivan, do you, since you do serve on the Marion County Solid Waste Advisory Committee, is that correct? There are costs, I'm assuming, to these recycling programs. So wouldn't the county offer that already if there was markets for the plastic? Because I do know that you have a pretty robust recycling program.
We have been the top in the last 4 years for recycling in the whole state of Oregon. And so, yes, there are costs. And I don't really have, you know, the information to give to you, and neither am I a spokesperson for that. But I could certainly get that information to the committee if you would like that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And the last folks, Jeff Krupp, who I'm not going to give the last word, but almost the last word. And for those who don't know, Jeff Krupp is a former state representative. We worked together on many bills, and we're called the Odd Couple of Oregon. So my other half-odd couple is here. Vince Paparlarda, I hope I'm saying that right. Is there a Vince in the audience? I'm just going to have you come up. And then Randy Tucker. No. Okay. Did you want to come up and testify?
Oh, boy. The
new odd couple.
Yes, the new odd couple.
Talk about an odd couple.
I went over and told him, watch, we're going to get called up together.
And is there anybody else, since there's another seat up here, that would like to testify in this bill? Okay. Welcome back. I know that you miss us.
Oh, terrible. Do I need this thing? Probably not.
And could you please state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm a former state representative, Jeff Krupp. I'm a recovering politician, a 12-step program. And part of that recovery process is being the state director of a statewide nonprofit organization that believes in the Founding Fathers' vision of constitutionally limited government, otherwise known as Americans for Prosperity. We have about 20,000 members in 32 local chapters all around Oregon. I know.
I am keeping you to 2 minutes because we...
Because you know me. And for the record, we don't take any oil money or any plastic money or any money from any of the folks that have been in the room talking about this issue. We oppose this Senate bill for one main reason. There are minor reasons, but the main reason for us is it's an issue of limited consumer choice. And we believe that it is a fine line to walk between freedom, and it's a fine line to walk between what is in the public's best interest. We think this goes too far in terms of banning plastic bags. I will tell you that I think many of the goals of this legislation are achievable without the plastic bag ban. The industry can certainly come to you and put a fee on to encourage customers to use that type of a bag. The industry can certainly come to you and create a statewide standard without having to ban plastic bags. Quick anecdotal note for you is my farm covers about a half a mile of a very busy state highway, Cascade Highway. Actually, it's a county highway. And it is a garbage dump for people. And it, to no end, this angers me. Because I believe in picking up after myself as a fifth-generation Oregonian, like I believe you all do. But rarely are there plastic bags out there. What there are bottles and cans and paper products. I know, because I'm out there picking them up.
We have another bill coming.
I know you probably do. So I would just say this, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. If bad behavior creates the spectacle that I have to endure on my farm or on beaches or other places, you've heard heartfelt testimony today because people are irresponsibly throwing away plastic bags. What makes you think they're not going to throw away a big bag like that? Because I think they will. This is a human nature problem. And we, I think, as a state and as an industry, can, as you've heard, people not knowing that there was recycling available for plastic bags here today, we can do a better job, clearly, of articulating that and giving people the opportunity to do that. So I would just ask you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, please consider not passing this bill. If you do, please consider amending it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
How'd I do for time, by the way?
You went over.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm here testifying primarily on behalf of Kim Smith, the director of the Oregon Zoo, but also on behalf of the rest of Metro. As you may or may not know, the zoo is a project of Metro, and Kim came and testified before the earlier version of this committee in December, so I've submitted testimony very similar to what was submitted at that time. And so just at a very high level, I'll just make a couple of quick comments because most of the points have already been made by their other testifiers. The mission of the Oregon Zoo is to inspire the community to create a better future for wildlife. And they do that through not only hosting 1.6 million visitors a year and through education programs, but also through direct species conservation programs and through advocating for policies at the state and national level that to protect both Pacific Northwest wildlife and wildlife globally. And so you've already heard about from the Surf Rider Foundation probably and others about the impacts on the oceans from plastic bags. That similar testimony is in our written testimony. I should note though that the zoo walks its talk by not using any plastic bags, straws, or cup lids in its shops and concessions for that very reason. Metro, of course, also has significant responsibilities with respect to solid waste in the Portland region. We are sort of the wholesale end of the solid waste system, the local governments, the cities and counties franchise the haulers. The haulers bring the garbage and the recycling to a facility either operated and owned by us or licensed by us. As you've already heard from Far West Fibers and others about the problems that plastic bags cause in the recycling program and the numbers in terms of the amount of cost and materials that can't be recycled. So I'm not going to repeat that information. Just note for the record that the Metro Council, did in fact pass a resolution in support of this legislation last month, and I've attached that to the testimony that I submitted. And I'll just say one last thing, that I've learned something here today. I'm not a shopper like Ralph Groner, and I never heard of a store called White House Black Market, so I've learned something today. At any rate, happy to answer any questions if you have them. Oh, by the way, there was a question, or that you mentioned that I was here.
There was a question earlier that Senator Olson had asked DEQ,
right,
about recycling programs in the state of Oregon, and why isn't the state sort of requiring that these plastic bags be recycled?
So we do collect, first of all, we don't have anything to do with the curbside programs except for convening the local governments to discuss how those operate. As you've, I believe, already heard, you know, it's a high priority to keep plastic bags out of the curbside programs because of the contamination problems. We do accept source-separated plastic bags at our
transfer stations.
Thank you. I just couldn't come up with it. I think our main service with respect to plastic bags and other kinds of problematic waste streams is the Recycling Information Center, which provides information for the public about where they can recycle various types of waste, including plastic bags. We've received over 1 million calls through the course of the history of the Recycling Information Center. Now a lot more of that action is online, but we still get a lot of calls. So happy to try to get some more data for you or more specific information if you have some information requests from our solid waste planners and policy people.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Questions?
And I thought I was long-winded.
Was that more? Was that
we're over 2 minutes too, but I figured you both were.
Challenge
Senator
Jeff
Prezonsky
to a sing-off.
That's kind of more of a.
We're not going to let Jeff get away this easy, are we?
Can't do that.
Okay. Remember, I'm the guy that introduced the Elvis bill. So.
I thought you'd show up in your leather.
Yeah, you and
I learned.
Randy.
Yes, and it was bipartisan.
It was the first mistake
I ever made. Not the bipartisan, but the Elvis thing.
Yes, it was.
So, yeah,
we all remember.
There are questions, Senator Prezonsky?
There's not a question, but Jeff, you said that you don't take funding from plastic or paper industry. Actually,
right. We do not.
Koch brothers were the founding, one of the founding founders of American for Prosperity.
Senator and Senator Prezonsky, please understand there's a differentiation between Americans for Prosperity, the national organization, and Americans for Prosperity Oregon. We do not receive any funding from the Koch Foundation, Koch Brothers, or Georgia-Pacific, or any of their affiliates.
Right, but you wouldn't have the association in Oregon if it wasn't from the Koch Brothers starting the national. And it's interesting, having a laptop here, you actually kind of get to do some research while you're hearing testimony. And the Koch brothers also fund the indirectly through the Heritage Foundation, the Beacon Hill Institute of Suffolk University, as well as the Americans for Tax Reform. So quite interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. Senator Olson, you're going to have the last word.
Well, not probably. Mr. Krupp, as a member or the president of Americans for Prosperity, do you believe that this bill is social engineering?
Perhaps to some extent that it is, in that it seeks to change social behavior. And it's obvious that, forgive me for forgetting protocol.
Okay, it's, yeah.
Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, geez, you would think I would know this stuff after 8 years in this building. To some degree, it is. The obvious issue, the people are speaking because they prefer typically plastic bags over paper. That's why it is the abundant supply of it that is in the marketplace today. So to the extent that you're trying to modify people's behavior through the heavy hand of a mandate in terms of legislation, i.e. taking away the consumer choice, yes, to that degree it is. Again, I go back to the point that I think you can achieve the same goal, but in a different manner, and I would encourage you to consider that.
One follow-up question. Mr. Krupp, would it be possible that the stores themselves, Safeway and Fred Meyer's, could just not use plastic bags?
Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, yes, absolutely true. And in fact, I think that the industry itself could come to you, as many of the association groups have done in prior times when I served with you in this body, and as they are likely to do in this session, and come to you and say, give us the legal authority to impose a 5 cent a bag fee across the industry, and you would give that to them, and they would in essence tax themselves, or in deference to Senator Haas, fee themselves. And it would be the industry then themselves choosing to level that playing field and not the state government saying that it has to be so. And that, to me, is a more freedom-oriented choice. And you could do that, again, without having to ban plastic bags. And you could still achieve the goal of reducing plastic bag consumption.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, thank you for supporting that 5 cents fee, since I've got the last word. But thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it, and appreciate your patience. And with that, unless there's anybody else that would like to testify before this gavel falls, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 536. And thank you for your patience, committee members. And we will close the hearing for February 8th, and we'll see you on Thursday.